Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. I'm going to talk about what's going on over in the state legislature. I'll tell you what, more attacks on workers and some fairly interesting alliances popping up. Also going to talk about more tragedy on the job as workers suffer at the expense of profit. Even the Pope has a say in that. And the more governor jobs, the more jobs governor, well, those unemployed, they're just drug addicts. They're lazy drug addicts. First they're lazy, now they're drug addicts. The more jobs governor. Yeah, and even that, you know, laughable on so many levels. We're going to talk about that. Also, the screwquester, harming workers, harming families across the country at a time when we're giving billions away to special interests and, of course, to Wall Street. In New York City, there is a resolution that has been put forth to encourage the passage of a transaction tax on Wall Street, something we've been talking about for a couple of years now. The Tobin tax, the Robin Hood tax, whatever you want to call it. It is a small sales tax on these millions and billions of trades that go on every day, especially with these supercomputers. You know, for me, I say you tax the hell out of those. Because even the guy who came up with this scam, even the guy who was integral in part of this, says, you know, there's no real good to it. It's all about institutions making a couple of bucks for themselves, because it doesn't trickle down to you and me. Nope, not at all. Anyway, thoughts, comments, questions, something on your mind, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Good day today. It's May Day, International Labor Day. You know, here in the U.S., we celebrate Labor Day in September, and look, we didn't take May 1st because, well, the communists, it's a communist plot. You know, standing up for workers' rights, communist plot. And there are still Republicans today who believe that. They believe that anything that has to do with workers having a say on the job, having the ability to fight for better wages, hours, and conditions, that's communism, socialism. It's the end of it. It's all over. For me, I remember as a kid watching those old-time movies. And, you know, the plane's been hit. Mayday, mayday, we're going down. Sound of distress. And for me, the idea of mayday has a couple of meanings. One of them is that the childhood memory, that we, as a middle class, are going down. And really, honestly and truthfully, spiraling downward. You look at the facts as they are. And, you know, you think about, did a recovery happen from the Bush collapse? Yeah, it happened. The vast majority of us never shared in it, but it happened. You look at the report by Emmanuel Saez and his partner. You know, the 93% of the first year new income went to the top 1%. The year after, 121% of that new income to the top 1%. You know, who didn't see any move forward in that income? You know who didn't see any bump in their standard of living? You, me, my neighbors. So when I hear mayday, it's a call for, this is a distress time. This is a distress signal. And we really need to be thinking of the crisis that's been created. Inequality in this country, go back to the Great Depression, never wider. It's never been wider between the haves and the have-nots. You look at the CEO pay that is off the charts. Completely off the charts. Retirement packages for the executives in the CEO class, off the charts. At a time when we're talking about chain CPI, at a time when we're talking about lowering people's Social Security, lowering that retirement security, are you kidding me? In fact, things are so bad that the new Pope himself has come out and said, hey, you know, there's something seriously going on. He said, I think of the difficulties that in various countries today afflict the world of work and business. He said, I think of how many, and not just young people, are unemployed, many times due to a purely economic conception of society, which seeks selfish profit beyond the parameters of social justice. Imagine this. I may end up back in the Catholic Church yet. A Catholic Pope talking about social justice. And he said, I wish to extend an invitation to solidarity to everyone. And I'd like to encourage those in public office to make every effort to give new impetus to employment. So you've got a Pope. I'm telling you, who knows? I may end up back in the Catholic Church yet. A Pope talking about social justice, a Pope talking about full employment. Is this something of anti-austerity? Is this something of going, hey, it doesn't work. It hurts people. Stop it. He went on to talk about the tragedy in Bangladesh, which we will talk about later in the program. That he says, living on 38 euros a month, this was the payment of these people who have died. This is called slave labor. I mean, think about that. I'm telling you, it may end up before you know it. And you look at this and you go, what are our politicians doing? What are the people in D.C. doing? What are the people in Harrisburg doing? We've got our more jobs governor, Tom Corbett, our more jobs governor, pointing the finger at those unemployed. Well, here's the clip, and this is one of those things that, you know, you can't make this stuff up. If you remember back when he was running for governor, it's because they're lazy. These people just sit around. They're lazy. They don't do anything. They're just lazy. We need to force them back to work by lowering benefits and cutting them off the program. And that's what ScrewQuester is doing as well. Understand, the right loves to push that ScrewQuester. But, you know, Tom Corbett, now it's no longer that they're lazy. Now it's, well, they're just drug addicts.
There are many employers that say, you know, we're looking for people, but we can't find anybody that has passed the drug test, a lot of them. And that's a concern for me, because we're having a serious problem with that.
Yeah, we just have a serious problem with these drug addicts who can't pass a test. Could it be, and this is one of those things that gets me, you stop and you think about all of the jobs that have been lost during his tenure. Not lost. We know where they are. They were destroyed. They were burned in effigy, if you will. They were burned because they were those public sector workers. And those aren't real jobs, of course not. You know, those teachers and those cops and those firefighters, you know, the people we called heroes in Boston, those aren't real jobs. No. Those are the jobs that are gone. And 20,000 education professionals kicked to the curb. And this is the guy who calls himself the more jobs governor. Understand, and this is across the country and here in Pennsylvania, for every person that's out there looking for a job, there's a quarter of a job somewhere. Because for every job out there are four people looking for it. So you're going to tell me, now if I get this straight, and help me with this, because I'm struggling. If I'm offering a job to somebody, say, oh, you know, it's a big problem. I can find nobody. There's no one to fill these jobs because I got all these jobs. No one to fill because none of them can pass drug tests. You're telling me that the four people who show up for that one job, you're telling me that when Walmart throws up a sign and 600-700 people, 1,000 people show up, none of those people can pass a drug test? None of the unemployed? Are you trying to tell me that it is that heavily weighted?
What I dispute is the use of statistics.
Yeah, I know you don't believe in statistics, Tom. But, you know, are you telling me this? Because I'm kind of struggling with it. I'm kind of struggling with the fact that the guy who came in saying he was going to focus on jobs, has not passed a jobs plan, has led one of the worst records on job creation. It's not his fault. And I saw this piece over at Politics PA that caught my attention. And we're going to talk about it a little bit later. But, you know, some of the information in it, I like Politics PA. I read it every once in a while. This piece, and I like Keegan, the guy who wrote it. But, you know, here again, you got to wonder, you know, how much of this is from the Corbett campaign? Were they Or they push back and say, well, you know, that seventh, the 49th job creation number, that's not right. And it may not be completely accurate. But in engaging with this guy from Arizona State, the numbers that he used, they're fairly accurate. And it may not be 7th to 49th. It may be more like 13th to 49th or 13th to 45th. It's still showing that we're headed in the wrong direction. And what gets me about this kind of stuff is that, you know, the finder, hey, we got serious problems. And they'll point, wow, you see those, they're wrong. Job creation in this state has not increased. And for all the talk of creating 110,000 private sector jobs, you've cost us, you know, in excess of 20,000 public sector jobs, which is trickled down into the rest of the economy and cost jobs there. But I question that 110,000 number. Is it Republican math? Could you make the argument using Tom Corbett math? That Linda Thompson, the mayor of Harrisburg, who's gone through, what, 5, 6, 10 communication directors who quit or get fired, could you make the argument that, you know, she's created 10 jobs if it's been 10 people? Because that's the argument that they use. Wow, we created, you know, 100,000 or whatever the number was, Marcellus Shale jobs. When you find out, you know, they hired and fired one guy, one position, like 10 times. So it's interesting to me how all of this stuff plays out, especially today on May Day. To me, Workers International Labor Day. Because I look at this and I go, you know, we need to be creating jobs. We need to have full employment. We need to run away from austerity. Cut and punish doesn't even make sense. I mean, this is the part that gets me. There is no logical basis for it whatsoever. It makes no sense. Oh, well, you know, we're saving tax dollars at the state level. Okay. But you're pulling a ton of money out of the economy. And that reverberation effect that, according to the IMF, they thought was 50 cents for every dollar of public money you pull out of the economy, 50 cents would be lost. Turns out it was 250. Because maybe they forgot to change the Excel file. Maybe they forgot to update the formula on the program, like the other one that they keep using. But just from a purely logical, common sense position, if you're slowing down the economy, you are slowing down the economy, which is going to cost you more jobs in the long run. And this is where I think the Pope, I'm spot on with Pope Francis. Good for him. Social justice, full employment. That's the way we should be going. And if we could throw some peace in there, I'd be happy. Take me back to the Catholic Church that I grew up in. Even though while they were practicing peace, the nuns were beating the living daylights out of me. Just is what it is. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. From the top.
Smith Show, changing America for the better. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Warehouse Workers United's Elizabeth Brennan says that Walmart refused to accept petitions calling for the reinstatement of worker activist Javier Rodriguez. Rodriguez was fired from a Walmart warehouse in California's Inland Empire last Thursday.
They invented a reason to demote him last Friday, and then on Thursday, just a few days ago, they called him into the office, said they had conducted an investigation of which he wasn't part of, and told him that he was fired, that he should get his things and leave. So we immediately launched a petition and got the word out about this, and the response has been really overwhelming. We're asking that he be reinstated to his job as a forklift driver at this warehouse, and we're directing that to Walmart. They hold all the cards in this situation.
Brennan says workers formed Warehouse Workers United to fight to improve bad working conditions in the warehouses that ship Walmart goods to the stores. Brennan says Javier Rodriguez was fired for his labor organizing
organizing and activism to improve working conditions, and Walmart is responsible.
He works in 100% Walmart contracted warehouse, so everything they touch ends up on the shelves of Walmart. Last year, he started organizing with his coworkers to improve the working conditions. They were facing extreme temperatures over 100 degrees, lots of dust, broken equipment, high rates of injury. Sometimes they didn't have access to drinking water. And he and a bunch of his coworkers went out on strike. They don't have the protection of a union. They're incredibly courageous and brave.
The United Mine Workers of America rallied more than 6,000 people in St. Louis Monday in the latest round of the union's battle to preserve promised health care benefits for retired miners and their dependents. Peabody Coal spun off a company called Patriot Coal. Now Patriot is in bankruptcy court, where a decision will be made about the company effort to deprive miners of those promised benefits. 16 people were arrested at the rally on Monday. The U.S. may not be as short on tech workers as some CEOs would have us believe. Jesse Russell reports.
The IT industry is pushing for an immigration bill that would allow for more work visas for foreign workers with specialized skills. A new report by the Economic Policy Institute finds that the country already has a surplus of domestic workers skilled in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. According to the report, for every 2 U.S. graduates with an IT-related degree, only 1 is hired in the industry. Of those IT graduates who weren't hired into their field, 32% said it was because they couldn't find a job, and 53% said there were better opportunities outside of the IT industry. One of the key findings is that wages in the industry have stagnated at the 1990 levels. The report hypothesizes that the amount of foreign-born IT workers in the country on visas has deflated wage growth in the sector.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Your working class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Working hard to make a left, rich and barbaric. Father, son, left the cameo, blue denim, head is big. Oh, he's a working class man.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So I got an interesting email pointing out that Daryl Metcalf, the representative from the western part of the state, had a meeting with two gentlemen from the embassy of Azerbaijan. And evidently there's a piece of legislation that's been referred to the state government committee that these two gentlemen from Azerbaijan, the embassy there, weren't happy about. And the way when I looked into it, because, of course, Representative Metcalf didn't bother to say, you know, what it was about, so I called his office. He said it was about House Resolution 274, which was to give this community in this country democratic rights. And I just found it very interesting that a guy who talks about states' rights, a guy who believes in states' rights, would be against someone having states' rights. In fact, he said that he would stop the resolution in the state government committee for the good folks of Azerbaijan. Just an interesting thought from our favorite representative. Anyway, here to talk about what's going on in the state and around the country, I've got our good friend Erwin Aronson. Erwin, thanks for taking time for me.
Good to be here, Rick. How are you?
I am good. Something caught my attention last week, and I don't know if you saw this. State Senator Eichelberger put out a co-sponsorship memo to change Act 111 to basically take collective bargaining rights away from cops and firefighters. And you know, at a time when we're holding the folks up in Boston as heroes, at a time where, you know, in this country we look at cops and firefighters as heroes, I found it very interesting that Senator Eichelberger would choose that moment to go after those heroes.
Well, why would you find it intriguing? Why would you find it interesting? I think it's as predictable as the sunrise. You know, people who are heroes to the rest of the world are the enemy to those who wish to use their positions in government to strip citizens of their rights. Act 111, in case our listeners aren't as familiar as I am stuck with being because of what I do for a living, is the law that protects and assures that police and firefighters in Pennsylvania have the right to organize and bargain collectively over wages and terms and conditions of employment. And the law is interesting and it's unique because police and firefighters in Pennsylvania, while having the right to organize and collectively bargain, do not have a right to strike. So if they reach an impasse in collective bargaining with their employers, their public sector employers, it's submitted to final and binding arbitration. The dispute is submitted to final and binding arbitration. And an independent, neutral third party renders a decision about what the terms and conditions of employment should be. And what is happening now is that Senator Eichelberger is saying that professional dispute resolution folks should be taken out of the mix, and instead what we should have is that police and firefighters be subject to the yoke. And it is sadly not shocking, sadly not surprising, but what it is repugnant to anything that speaks of liberty and justice in a society where we have come to learn all too frequently and all too painfully and all too sadly that it's those very cops and firefighters who are running into the buildings when everybody else has to be running away, who are running into the danger zone when everybody else is running away. So I think police, firefighters, and more importantly, all citizens should take note of that when Senator Eichelberger comes again and asks for their vote and their support and their political contributions and for his election or reelection.
Yeah, but I look at this, and again, it's this dividing us. And, you know, I go back to the Jay Gould quote, I could easily pay half the working class to kill the other half. And I look at this dividing that's going on of the public sector and the private sector, non-union workers and union workers, and it's all about pitting us against each other. I guess, moreover, to mask the fact that they've done nothing to create jobs in our state, even though in 2010 our governor, he said he was going to be jobs, jobs, jobs. In fact, he put out a thing the other day, said he was the more jobs governor. If you look at the facts don't bear this. What the facts bear is we're falling behind the rest of the country.
We're not falling behind. We have fallen behind. We're behind. We're not just a little bit behind. We're way behind. We have been placed in the position under this governor and his policies of dropping from, I think, fifth in job creation at the time he was elected to 47th out of 50 states in job creation. He's created jobs for a couple of his political cronies. He's created a job for himself by pandering to the corporate interests. He's created all manner of activities for people from outside of Pennsylvania. His idea of creating jobs was to run off to Brazil a couple of weeks ago and take some of his corporate buddies with him. But when it comes to family-sustaining jobs with family-sustaining benefits in Pennsylvania, he gets a grade, and he should be measured by his grade. His grade is F, maybe F-.
I want to get your thought on a comment he made this week. It's something we're going to be talking about later with Democratic Party Chairman Pennsylvania Democratic Party Chairman Jim Byrne. But, you know, this again, it shows this dismissive attitude towards workers and really this a disdain for unemployed working people. He had this to say.
There are many employers that say, you know, we're looking for people, but we can't find anybody that has passed the drug test, a lot of them. And that's a concern for me because we're having a serious problem with that.
You've got a serious problem, Irwin. There are all these drug addicts who won't take jobs because they can't pass the test.
Well, this guy initially showed his public disdain for working men and women when he was a candidate for governor. If you recall, and I suspect you do, in discussing his view of unemployment insurance law as a candidate for governor of Pennsylvania, he urinated all over unemployed Pennsylvanians in the height of the Great Recession. And he didn't apologize then. He didn't back off from his comments then. And here we are a couple of years later, and he's doing it again. It's not a mistake. It's not intentional. It's not a gaffe. And the best evidence we have that it's not a gaffe is that today, when faced with the opportunity to apologize for this inane statement, for this abusive statement, for this fundamentally disrespectful statement for the citizens, the highest office in our democracy, the citizens of our state, he didn't apologize. He got his buddies in the business community to issue a press release justifying his words. And what really comes clear out of this is that the governor just took the statements of some corporate fat cat leaders of this putative drug test issue and repeated it without bothering to check. And this is a guy, of course, who used to be the attorney general. The attorney general lives and breathes on evidence. And here's a guy who used to be the attorney general who didn't even check the facts and now won't recant. What a slap in the face to the hardworking victims of his policy.
And, you know, then looking at his policy, I mean, those unemployed folks who are being harmed by his policies every day, not from now forward, because of the unemployment compensation changes ushered through by this governor and these radicals. And I'm not even pointing at just the Republicans, these radicals who rammed through this this destruction of that safety net.
Oh, and there were a good number of Democrats in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives that joined with the governor and the Republicans. And, oh, by the way, this same group of conservatives, when they smashed and burned unemployment compensation eligibility and benefits in Pennsylvania, also simultaneously created the biggest single debt in the history of Pennsylvania and committed the taxpayers of Pennsylvania to a single $4-plus billion, that's with a B, bond issue, debt issue, to pay off the business community's debts to the unemployment compensation system for which they had failed to pay the bill not for a month, not even for a year, but for more than 20 years, nearly a quarter of a century. And Corbett's big act was to transfer their debt to us taxpayers instead of saying that for once they ought to pay something close to a reasonable portion of their fair share.
And, you know, I think about that, the fact that you hit it on the head. We bailed these employers out who have underfunded this for a generation at least, not only took over their debt, but gave them a tax cut to boot. And this from the guy who said that, well, said this.
Right now, we are hard at work to bring a major natural gas processing plant to southwestern Pennsylvania. The best argument we can make to the company behind the project is Pennsylvania's embrace of free markets.
They believe in free markets, Irwin. Free markets.
That's a lie. They don't believe in free markets. They pass out corporate welfare like it's taffy. There's nothing free about these markets. What's sad, what's free, what the governor failed to address at all today was his administration's announcement yesterday that they are laying off 108 people involved in the processing of unemployment compensation claims in Pennsylvania. And they did that in the face of a finding by the U.S. Department of Labor just a couple of months ago, in the middle of February, that Pennsylvania was in trouble because it wasn't adequately and timely processing unemployment insurance claims for the unemployed in Pennsylvania. So we're going to fix that by laying off 108 more people.
Sounds reasonable. And the unemployment, because we're not processing claims fast enough, so let's jam the system up more, because those people are just drug addicts, right?
Well, apparently, when you live in Corbett fantasy land, that's the reason people aren't getting jobs. If you live in Corbett fantasy land, there are plenty of jobs, there just aren't people to fill them.
But, you know, here's the thing, Irwin. The more jobs governor, he's created 110,000 jobs all by himself.
Well, I don't know. I heard him utter that as a candidate, that government doesn't create jobs. The job creators create jobs. So we gave all kinds of special tax breaks to the job creators, and then we bailed out their unemployment compensation debt. And then guess what? Pennsylvania's unemployment rate, even now, after all of this recession and all of this great corporate recovery activity, our unemployment numbers again for last month were higher than the national average in Pennsylvania. Higher than the national average.
But that's not his fault. It's not his fault.
Well, he thinks he's Teflon. Nothing's his fault. Nothing's his fault. And nothing to be apologized for. No smack at working men and women. No challenge to the real and meaningful issues and problems faced by Pennsylvania working families is worth so much as a second look or an apology. This is a man who has no self-doubt. This is a man who never looks over his shoulder. This is a man who seems to know with crystal clarity that if it comes out of his mouth, it must be right. So whether he's telling women to protect themselves from rape by holding their legs together or closing their eyes when they're compelled to have some kind of exam, a probe, is a guy who really ought to be the subject of a probe of his own.
Yeah. Now, I mean, I look at this and, you know, the missed opportunity. I mean, you know, there's, you know, the argument that his administration is saying is, well, you know, we've been just standing still. Everybody else in the country is doing much better. We it's not as bad as it looks because, you know, we haven't caused any real problems, but you haven't done anything. Even if you buy the argument that we've just been standing still, to me, that's political malpractice because we haven't done anything to move forward.
Well, it is political malpractice, but it's much worse than that. Political malpractice is a nice soundbite kind of term. But what we really need to winnow this down to is the impact. The numbers, thousands and thousands of my fellow Pennsylvanians and your fellow Pennsylvanians, who in the time of Corbett have given up looking for work. Thousands and thousands and tens of thousands more Pennsylvanians who are underemployed. Families that cannot, between a mom and a dad and the kids, sustain themselves. Because we've been Corbettized.
Well, that's because
and
those
the
are lazy
is,
people.
Just keep on repeating the big lie.
That's because those are lazy people. They're too lazy to find jobs, and now they're drug
addicts.
No,
they're not too lazy. They're spending all their welfare money and unemployment insurance on drugs.
But, you know, the sad thing, Erwin, is I talk to people, and this is what the message has been from the right for a couple of years now, since the Bush collapse. The message has been they're just too lazy or they're not smart enough or always pointing the finger at when the reality is you've got a governor and a political class that is doing everything they can do to slow our economy and cost us jobs.
Well, and not just cost us jobs, cost us whole industries, whole methods by which people made a living and sustained families. Destruction of communities, Rick. We're not just talking about a poor guy or gal who lost a job. We're talking about towns being wiped out. We're talking about education systems crumbling. We're talking about futures of our children being destroyed. And I think that's really what they want. They want to make sure that we have a dumbed-down class to fill the next group of low-paying jobs so that we can keep people under their thumbs. But someplace along the line, somebody has to ask that age-old question that Walter Reuther of blessed memory, former president of the United Automobile Workers, asked when he saw all the automated assembly lines that didn't have any workers on them. Just, who's going to buy all those cars? We dumbed down this workforce long enough and consistently enough and well-planned enough, as the Corbett and his buddies want to do, the Corbett colleague, pretty soon we will not have a workforce that can compete for the best jobs. We'll have a workforce that competes for the worst jobs.
Well, you're
and
right.
We
We're
have the race to the bottom, and yeah. We have people who cannot make the purchases in a consumer economy that allow the economy to grow. So Corbett apparently has made a decision to delegate the best jobs to Brazil, where he went a couple of weeks ago, or to Peru, or to China, or to anywhere but Pennsylvania. That's a breach of his oath of office. That's not just political malpractice.
I watched as he raised his hand and swore to uphold, protect, and defend our Constitution and our law. We, the people, have a right to depend on that. He's breached his oath. That's much, much more than mere political malpractice.
Let me ask you, last line of questioning. The big fight over the next couple of months is going to be over the pension. And one of the, a friend of mine yesterday asked me, because most people think something has to be done. I'm not so sure. None of the plans that I've seen, none of the ideas that I've seen come out of our legislature seem viable. It seems like it's going to cost me more money, it's going to have less benefits, and it's going to cause a bigger problem. I'm curious where you see this pension fight going in the coming days and weeks.
Well, I think it's going to be hand-to-hand combat. Corbett and his political supporters have suggested a philosophical change. Not an economic change. The philosophical change is to do away with pensions, do away with the opportunity for people who have given a dedicated life of service to have some potential of a decent retirement. And instead, they've suggested a plan that changes all that to have people not have any security in retirement. And it would be understandable, if not okay, if that was aimed at saving taxpayers' money, but his plan actually increases the burden on taxpayers, increases the debt, and doesn't address the debt that has been accumulated by Corbett and others who have failed to pay their fair share into the pension plans that are promised to current workers. And have played kick the can with that for a long time. What we did in 2010 is we adopted what has become known as Act 120, and Act 120 is working, and it's actually breaking down the debt. Even in a rotten economy, it's diminishing the debt. But what Corbett's proposed is to slash and burn Act 120 before it's had a chance to do its work, because pension funding is not a snapshot. It's a moving picture, and it takes time to work things up. And while it's working up, of course, we have people coming into the system and contributing and having contributions made on their behalf, which pays for the benefits that are due today, because the people who are coming into the system won't be eligible for benefits for a working lifetime. But Corbett has decided to artificially cut the amount from 4% to 2.2%. That's his legislative proposal of the wages that people earn, of the employer side contribution. So that's just going to make the debt worse, make the debt bigger, accumulate additional problems, which will give them an opportunity to come back after they've destroyed the right to a pension for future workers and slash some more and uh-huh. slash some more uh-huh. and pit one group of taxpayers against another. It's pure insanity, but the answer to your question is I believe it's going to be tough, difficult, demanding, literal hand-to-hand combat for those of us who are committed to protecting the right not merely of public workers, but of all citizens who benefit by the work of those public workers to protect their pensions. And, oh, by the way, one reminder where Pennsylvania is in first place. Pennsylvania has the lowest ratio of public workers to population in the country. And we still accumulate this debt because the Corbettites and others have played kick the can with their obligations to pay their side of the equation on public sector pensions, even as public employees have had their pension contributions deducted out of each and every paycheck, each and every pay period during which they work, never once missing a contribution or having their contributions lowered or diminished. So we're going to tell the story, and we're going to expose Corbett and his political buddies for what they are and what they're trying to do.
Well, it sounds like disaster capitalism at its best. And create these crises, and, well, as they've said, let a good crisis go to waste.
You got it. Contrive a crisis, and then contrive a solution that makes the crisis even worse.
Yep. Erwin, I always appreciate the time and the thoughts. Thanks so much.
Thanks for letting me be there, and I hope to talk to you next week.
Thanks so much, our good friend, Attorney Aaron Aronson. Quick break, right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Gosh, it seems like only yesterday that we saw George W. on TV reading The Pet Goat to some second graders. But now, he's all grown up and has an entire super-duper king-size library filled with big books and other neat stuff, all dedicated to him. Bush's Pharaonic Presidential Center is now open, allowing us commoners to dig deep into the shallowness of his achievements. The enormous building itself sets the tone, sharp edges, high brick walls, and the welcoming feel of a fortress. Yet, the ex-pres insists that it's a place for public contemplation of his legacy, quote, a place to lay out facts. How ironic is that? After all, the Bush-Cheney regime was infamous for its disregard of facts, as well as its constant hiding, twisting, and wholesale manufacturing of facts to fool the people. On everything the regime pushed, from going to war over Iraq's non-existent weapons of mass destruction, to its plan to gut and privatize Social Security, facts were whatever Bush, Cheney, Rummy, Rove, and Condi imperiously declared them to be. More ironic, and even insulting, is the centerpiece of the library's attempt to whitewash George's 8 awful years, an interactive exhibit called Decision Points Theater. And theater it is, portraying George heroically as the decider on such big moments as Hurricane Katrina and the Wall Street collapse. Visitors to this rigged exhibit can use touchscreens to see Bush getting contradictory advice, then taking a bold stand. The whole show is meant to make you feel sympathy for him. Then you're asked to vote on whether he did the right thing. Again, irony. We the people got no vote on these issues back when it would have mattered. This is Jim Hightower saying George's library is as big a fraud as his presidency was.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So as Erwin said, the Department of Labor and Industry, they're going to be firing, 108 employees. It's going to be mostly the union members. They're the folks who administer unemployment compensation and workforce development. Remember last week, Labor and Industry Secretary Julia Hartway said that, the SWAT team, we're going to have the SWAT team out there to help people get jobs. Not so much. The SWAT team's going to be laid off. And you got to wonder, people who lose their jobs, what's going to happen when you go to try and file for unemployment and go through this process, you're talking nobody there. And as I look at this, you add that to the 50 to 70 workers that are supposedly going to be fired from the Auditor General's office, another one of those moments where you go, political payback? You got Eugene DePasquale, the Democrat who is the Auditor General. Is this hampering that him? And I don't think it has any, I think it has everything to do with government. We don't want auditors looking into things. We don't want unemployed workers getting competent. We want to make the system so bogged down, so hard to navigate that, well, people just don't do it. This is the plan. It's that whole idea of disaster capitalism. And this from the guy who, he's the more jobs governor. The more jobs guy. And what just absolutely infuriates me is that the mainstream media, they're not covering it. For me, I look at this and I go, you know, man, wake up. All of these public sector jobs that have been slashed and cut off, all of this investment that's not happening, all of the people that has balanced the budget on the backs of, that's harmed our economy, all of that has harmed our economy. And you say, well, you know, he did give money to the big corporations away. Yeah, that left the state. It's not like he gave tax breaks to small little local businesses. It's not like Main Street got anything. It's those campaign contributors, man. They're the ones who got it. And I look at this politics PA piece that just leaves me scratching my head. It's the CEO class that this governor is concerned about. And I look at this story from over at Bloomberg that caught my attention. That this one CEO, former CEO of JCPenney's, a guy named Ron Johnson, 1,795 to 1. That's the wage difference. And you know, most CEOs, you know, it's anywhere from 200 to 350 times what the average worker makes. This guy took almost 1,800 times what one person, and they made a comparison between this CEO, who's no longer with the company, and this woman, Ms. Gonzalez, who made $8.30 an hour. And his compensation package worth 1,800 times, almost 1,800 times what she took, what she was earning. And for me, it calls into question the whole idea of how we compensate the very well-to-do, the people at the top. And societally, do we think it's right? I mean, you go back to when my grandparents' generation were in the heart of their working lives. The CEOs back then made 20 times what my grandfather made, what the average worker back then made. In the 1980s, it jumped to 42 times. By 2000, it was over 120 times, and now you're looking at, you know, anywhere from 204 up to 300, 400. Now you look at McDonald's, or the CEO there at McDonald's, you'd have to work 1,000,000 hours to earn what that guy takes. 1,000,000 hours. There's something seriously wrong. And the sad reality is what's gone on in this country is the lobbyists have taken over. The big moneyed special interests have taken over. And as the Bloomberg story pointed out, you've got this Washington-based HR firm, HR Policy Association. They represent the top executives of some 335 large corporations. And they say 17 of the companies on the HR Policy Board of Directors have CEO pay ratios in the top 20% of the S&P 500. You know, General Electric, McDonald's, AT&T, you know, the big boys. And they used this money to go after Dodd-Frank. Because, and I thought it was already part of the law that these big companies had to, by law, tell us what their CEOs make, tell us what the ratio of the median pay to the CEO pay, what that would be, that they have actually disclosed this. And the sad reality is, well, I was sadly mistaken. Because that's not the law, and it's part of, and it's because these lobbying firms have gone and, well, done such an amazing job of lobbying any movement towards any transparency. And you go back to, back in February, when the SEC commissioner at the time said that, well, we're working on it. We're working on the rule. We're working on it. Don't worry about us. The companies, they'll voluntarily disclose it. They'll police themselves, right? Because they're doing that so well now. And you look at the law, it's pretty specific. As it was written, it just hasn't been enforced. And what do you've got? You've got Republicans who are doing everything they can do, and some Democrats, to stop it. And Dave Johnson has a piece that points out that Section 953B of Dodd-Frank, which was passed in 2010, the Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, requires public companies to disclose the median annual total compensation of all employees, the total compensation of the CEO, and the ratio. It's been on the law. It's been on the books for 3 years. 3 years. Not implemented. And it's been blocked. Now, listen. I don't think Dodd-Frank is anywhere near strong enough. I don't think it's anywhere near what we should have done after the Bush collapse. To me, the minimum should have been reinstate Glass-Steagall. The minimum should have been erecting that wall between gambling banks and loaning banks. The guy I get my home mortgage from, the guy I get my car loan from, that's one side. The guy I go place my bets on Wall Street with, that's another guy. And the two should never mix. That hasn't really happened. And for me, I look at all of the money that's just being poured into this. And no oversight. Nothing. And if there is, I'm just not seeing it. You see the wealth being created on Wall Street. You see the stock wealth. You see the CEO pay going up. What'd they get? They got Obama, who did what George Bush couldn't do. Made permanent the Bush tax cuts. Yeah, there were some things in there, but at the end of the day, they made those permanent. Something Bush couldn't do. And I look at, all of the stuff that's going on. You and I, we just don't have the lobbying power. Well, that's not actually true. We have the lobbying power. We just don't use it enough. We should be calling our representatives. We should be organizing. We should be going, you know what? It would be nice to have a jobs plan, Governor Corbett. An infrastructure plan, transportation plan, at a minimum. But no. We should be funding education at the minimum. Funding it to make sure the future, my kid has a future. Healthcare, we should be doing that as well. But what we've got our governor doing, pairing up with Scott Walker as one of the very few governors in the country to oppose it. What's that going to mean for workers in our state? What's it going to mean for our neighbors, our friends, our family? What's it going to mean? They don't care. And that's the thing that really drives me nuts. They don't care. All I see is attack after attack after attack. By people who, you got to wonder how many of them have done an honest day's work in their lives. And I look at our friend Mad Cow, Daryl Metcalf. We're going to sign the people, the the people from the embassy of Azerbaijan to deny democracy to somebody. Now, you know, you would think that mad cow would be all in favor of states' rights, all in favor of local government, but yet look what they've done here. Look what the Republicans, what these extremists have tried to do here. Centralized control, taking local control away by giving the drillers carte blanche. Go ahead, drill wherever you want. Frack to your brains out. Fortunately, our Supreme Court said, not so fast. It's just one of those things that makes me very angry. And I hope you're angry about this, too. So the question is, what do we do about it? Well, we get to the streets. We say enough already. We start talking about what we need to be doing to rebuild a strong, vibrant middle class, which is why we're doing this labor history tour. Which is why we're going across country and going to discover community after community, their stories, the good, the bad, the ugly, uncover the past and look towards the future. You know, someone asked me, you know, what's the idea? The idea is simple. The idea is to look to the past when the mining jobs that people for generations lived in servitude to the company store. How did those become good-paying middle-class jobs, those factory jobs where people lived in tenements, in squalor? How did those become good, solid, middle-class jobs? And then looking to the jobs that are here today, the big-box retailers, the fast food, the restaurants, the service sector, how do we move that stuff forward? And for me, I'm hoping to see stories where there is organizing going on, where people have had enough, and people are saying, we're going to do something about it. Because it's one thing to complain, and it's one thing to get upset, and it's one thing to point fingers, which is why I love our politics. You never hear anybody say, you know what? I don't care about what the other guy's doing. Here's what I would do. All we see is finger pointing and name calling. Well, you know, the other guy, vote for me because the other guy sucks. Yeah, I know the other guy. I know Corbett sucks. I know he's bad. The question is, how do we turn that around? Which is why I truly believe we need politicians with vision and with really very progressive ideas. And let's hope that comes out of this next primary. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. Right back with hour two of the program. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Warehouse Workers United's Elizabeth Brennan says that Walmart refused to accept petitions calling for the reinstatement of worker activist Javier Rodriguez. Rodriguez was fired from a Walmart warehouse in California's Inland Empire last Thursday.
They invented a reason to demote him last Friday, and then on Thursday, just a few days ago, they called him into the office, said they had conducted an investigation of which he wasn't part of, and told him that he was fired, that he should get his things and leave. So we immediately launched a petition and got the word out about this, and the response has been really overwhelming. We're asking that he be reinstated to his job as a forklift driver at this warehouse, and we're directing that to Walmart. They hold all the cards in this situation.
Brennan says workers formed Warehouse Workers United to fight to improve bad working conditions in the warehouses that ship Walmart goods to the stores. Brennan says Javier Rodriguez was fired for his labor organizing and activism to improve working conditions, and Walmart is responsible.
He works in 100% Walmart contracted warehouse, so everything they touch ends up on the shelves of Walmart. Last year, he started organizing with his coworkers to improve the working conditions. They were facing extreme temperatures over 100 degrees, lots of dust, broken equipment, high rates of injury. Sometimes they didn't have access to drinking water. And he and a bunch of his coworkers went out on strike. They don't have the protection of a union. They're incredibly courageous and brave.
The United Mine Workers of America rallied more than 6,000 people in St. Louis Monday in the latest round of the union's battle to preserve promised health care benefits for retired miners and their dependents. Peabody Coal spun off a company called Patriot Coal. Now Patriot is in bankruptcy court, where a decision will be made about the company effort to deprive miners of those promised benefits. 16 people were arrested at the rally on Monday. The U.S. may not be as short on tech workers as some CEOs would have us believe. Jesse Russell reports.
The IT industry is pushing for an immigration bill that would allow for more work visas for foreign workers with specialized skills. A new report by the Economic Policy Institute finds that the country already has a surplus of domestic workers skilled in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. According to the report, for every two U.S. graduates with an IT-related degree, only one is hired in the industry. Of those IT graduates who weren't hired into their field, 32% said it was because they couldn't find a job, and 53% said there were better opportunities outside of the IT industry. One of the key findings is that wages in the industry have stagnated at the 1990 levels. The report hypothesizes that the amount of foreign-born IT workers in the country on visas has deflated wage growth in the sector.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
There are many employers that say, you know, we're looking for people, but we can't find anybody that has passed the drug test, a lot of them. And that's a concern for me, because we're having a serious problem with that.
Go, go, go. I messed up my entire life go, because I got high. Go, go, go. I lost my kids and wife because I got high.
Oh, well, there's the stereotype, isn't it? You know, our governor, well, nobody could pass a drug test. Nobody! So all of the folks in this who are unemployed, you're lazy and you're a drug addict. That's what our governor said. Not that the jobs aren't there, not that he's done everything he can do to make sure that they're not there. There's no transportation bill, there's no infrastructure, there's no education spending. No, hey, you're just lazy and a drug addict. That's all. And I love the Philly Daily News headline, the Big Bong Theory. Corbett jobless numbers are high because workers are too. And the question is, you look at the job numbers, you look at what this governor has done, is it because of lazy drug addict workers, or is it because of bad policy, bad direction, and really just the nonsense led by our Republican friends here in the legislature, which is why I've asked Jim Byrne, chairman of the Pennsylvania Democratic Party, to come talk to us about the governor's recent statements. Jim, thanks for taking time for me.
Good evening. Thanks for the invitation.
So what do you think? We got a bunch of lazy, drunken, high, unemployed folks who just can't find jobs.
Well, it's not the first time he's insulted a class of struggling individuals who are trying to get up on their feet and can't because of his policies when he was campaigning. I mean, he made a remark that folks would prefer to receive unemployment than go out and look for work. I've been in this business 20 years now, and at different levels of government. I've never met a more disconnected, disinterested, callous, elected official who doesn't care. And he makes no attempts to explain himself. He doubles down when he makes statements like this. Bad policies have led to unemployment in Pennsylvania, not drugs.
But yeah, I look at this, and you go back to the 20,000 education professionals who his budgets have booted to the curb. You look at all of the folks who have lost their jobs because of the cuts to health care, the programs that are meant to help the disabled, the needy, sick children, you name it, all those programs to help folks at the very bottom, the most vulnerable in our state. And you go, all of those jobs gone. And of course the reverberation effect of those jobs being pulled out of the economy. Yet this guy's got the audacity, the unmitigated gall, to call himself the more jobs governor, claiming he's created 110,000 jobs. I'm curious your thought.
I'm not gonna, if anybody's acting like they're under the influence, it's the governor. He's just living in a fantasy land here. I don't know where he thinks he has a record to be proud of, especially in that regard. And these attempts to been this abysmal plummet from number 7 to number 49 in the nation is ridiculous. So we took a tumble because of some of the specific items you've mentioned. We're struggling and we're suffering. We went from a position of leadership in these columns to dead last. Leaders also know when they've made mistakes or have done the wrong thing that they have to shift gears, move in a different direction, and admit to some culpability. Not only is he in complete denial, but he's actually bragging. It's an utter and complete failure of leadership.
Well, let me ask you about, because that's come up from 7th to 49th, and I've seen the study, and I've talked to people about it. The Corbett people are claiming that, well, it's not as bad as it looks, because, Pennsylvania, we weren't as far behind as everyone else. It's just we haven't done anything during his tenure, so it's not our fault.
Well, I mean, the excuses are ridiculous, and the spin they're trying to put on this, that it's not that bad, it's very bad. They've tried to push back with some data and some statistics. We're sticking by the numbers. They are what they are, irrespective of where we were a few years ago compared to where other states were. The fact is, other states with leaders who know how to build consensus, compromise, and include everyone, were able to go into the fast lane and move their states forward. This man not only stuck us in neutral, but he actually threw us into reverse. So his attempts to spin this unfortunate and tragic data, they're not fooling anybody, quite frankly.
It's interesting you brought up work for everyone. I look at State Senator Eichelberger's co-sponsorship memo, and I don't know if you've seen this or not, where he's calling for basically the destruction of collective bargaining rights for cops and firefighters. Especially at a time when we're looking to Boston, calling those folks heroes. You go back to 9/11, you look at the heroes that ran into the buildings as they were collapsing. And I'm looking at this co-sponsorship memo that Senator Eichelberger has proposed, and it's to destroy their working conditions. It's to destroy their wages, their benefits. And to me, this is just downright despicable, but not unpredictable.
It's despicable and it is not unpredictable, but it's hypocritical as well. This is the party that, especially the Tea Party element, that attempts to hold the high ground on patriotism, wraps themselves with the American flag and says that they are more patriotic than the Democratic Party. Yet they will go after first responders, go after the safety net of the Americans who need it the most. And with police and fire, I mean, that hits personal with me, who served as a mayor for 12 years. Since 9/11, this is the first time since the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, where there's a combatant, sometimes a foreign combatant, on our home soil. And these men and women are as much on the front line as our brave men and women who fight overseas. And to decline or deprive them of these types of things and to make cuts on a front line in these types of battles, it's unconscionable, especially coming from the folks who pride themselves on these types of issues and from someone who has been in law enforcement himself. Unacceptable.
Yeah, I agree. Listen to the Rick Smith Show with Jim Byrne, chairman of the Pennsylvania Democratic Party. So while we're seeing this and these attacks on workers, and it's a long laundry list of ALEC proposed legislation, of model legislation from the national scene that we've seen working its way through our legislature, what really infuriates me, and trust me, the other stuff does, is the fact that we're failing to invest in the future of this state, failing to invest in education, failing to invest in infrastructure. And to me, there's got to be an alternative. So, as you're looking at the 2014 race and the gubernatorial field that you guys are going to be putting up, are those going to be key issues? Talking about, we need roads and bridges. We need education. We need broadband access across this state. We need to be that state of the 21st century that looks forward and says, we're going to attract business with not only our location, but an educated workforce and a sound infrastructure.
Absolutely. Those are key talking points.
I don't think they're just talking points. I think these have got to be what we stand on.
Well, yeah, and I didn't mean to just limit it to just saying they're just talking points. These are the talking points that we need to act on, that we need to build on. These things need to become reality. They could have been reality with this governor. He had partners on the other side of the aisle that know that infrastructure, and especially out here in the West where I live, where we've needed a Marshall Plan in America and in Pennsylvania since the Marshall Plan in Europe. These things are not one-time fixes, temporary jobs, you come in, you build the road, you come out. No, no, no. They create an economic ripple effect. Infrastructure is an artery of commerce. You can get in and out. The bridges are safe. The roads are accessible. You expand them for businesses to come and invest, for families to come and grow. You create educational opportunities. You put more teachers into the schools. You create incentive for children to learn, a conducive environment for education. You put first responders on the streets so these families and businesses look out the window and see a police car on patrol, see a fire truck driving by when needed. And you have that safety net. And these aren't things, these aren't handouts. This is economy. This is real work. These are people rolling up their sleeves, earning a living, and making a better life. We have seen none of that. And again, back to going from 7 to 49, and this man is patting himself on the back for that.
Yeah, but totally here's the thing. Those public sector, those aren't real jobs. Come on, Jim, you know that. They're not real jobs. Those people don't collect real paychecks and do real work. They just sit on their behinds and collect gilded pensions.
Well, that's you know, what's scary is these folks are drinking their own tea when they make those types of statements. They truly believe these things. When we all know, when even moderate Republicans who are in hiding right now know that nothing could be further from the truth. These men and women are as much the backbone of our society as any other working demographic.
Let me ask you a last line of question, because one of my biggest fears is that we've seen the gerrymandering of the state. We've seen, you know, basically Rorschach tests all across our state. If you look at some of these districts, you go, I don't see the logic. One of my big concerns, though, is we're seeing this Senate Bill 538 proposed by Majority Leader Pileggi, who is basically saying, you know, we're going to rig the state of Pennsylvania so that we're no longer a battleground state. We will be a full-fledged, in the back pocket of the GOP, red state from now until the end of time. And for me, I look at this and I go, you know, this has got to be for that decent, honest conservative, for the people who believe in institution, who I respect, who have conservative values. You've got to look at this and go, this is anything but conservative. This is radical.
That's absolutely right. And you have to appreciate some of the pushback, like you said, conservatives who look forward to a healthy debate with Democrats and coming to a consensus and moving forward. You've got to appreciate some of those folks who have pushed back on this. And even some of the folks who aren't exactly moderate Republicans, some of the more extreme, vice presidential candidate Paul Ryan pushed back against this in his state. My colleague, Republican state chairman in Pennsylvania, Rob Gleason, did not think this was a good idea. And many other leaders in the Republican Party, some in Pennsylvania and others across this nation where this concept has been floated, have said, no way, this is a fundamental tenet of how we, of our Constitution. It should not be tinkered with in any state. But the only state where there's still a pulse on this, unfortunately, is here with Mr. Pileggi, Mr. Corbett, and Mr. Terzak.
And, you know, I look at this, Jim, and I say, you know, it's more division. It's more distraction. It's, hey, the shiny thing. Keep us focused on the fact, on this stuff, instead of the fact that their job creation numbers are abysmal. Their policy is abysmal. And the policy that these people are pushing, that they're pursuing, to me, is not conservative. It is radical. It is far out to the extreme, because it's not intended to make our state better. And I look at this letter put out by our junior senator, Pat Toomey, pimping money for the Commonwealth Foundation, the Tea Party think tank, because we're going to go after those workers. We're going to really stick it to them. To me, I got to be honest. I got a U.S. senator out there pimping for a Tea Party think tank. We got some really big problems with some really radical people running things.
That's absolutely right. And what happens when you don't have a policy or you don't have an idea, or the ideas that you do have are failing or aren't for the best interests of all people? You create diversions. You create red herrings. You throw a curveball. You talk about rigging an election. When you have insulted just about every single demographic except for middle-aged white men and lose miserably, you would think that you would learn to retool your message to be more consistent and inclusive, but no. You double down on chicanery, gamesmanship, try to rig an election, try to create crazy voter ID laws, and continue to introduce a radical, disconnected agenda because you don't see the public as the ultimate objective to your service. You see the public as an obstacle to your further desires to acquire more power.
Excellent
and that's
point.
Where they are right now.
Yeah,
it's not
point.
About people. It's about politics.
Yeah, you know, and for me, it comes back, if you can't win, cheat.
That's our, unfortunately, the new Republican Party leadership in Pennsylvania.
Sad stuff. Jim, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate the time.
My pleasure. You and your listeners have a great evening.
You too. Thanks so much. Jim Byrne, chairman of the Pennsylvania Democratic Party. Quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Corruption are very well known. On a Pennsylvania code of silence is what they defend. We know it, so let's don't pretend. You and me know it, so let's don't pretend.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Gosh, it seems like only yesterday that we saw George W. on TV reading The Pet Goat to some second graders. But now, he's all grown up and has an entire super-duper king-size library filled with big books and other neat stuff, all dedicated to him. Bush's Pharaonic Presidential Center is now open, allowing us commoners to dig deep into the shallowness of his achievements. The enormous building itself sets the tone, sharp edges, high brick walls, and the welcoming feel of a fortress. Yet, the ex-pres insists that it's a place for public contemplation of his legacy. Quote, a place to lay out facts. How ironic is that? After all, the Bush-Cheney regime was infamous for its disregard of facts, as well as its constant hiding, twisting, and wholesale manufacturing of facts to fool the people. On everything the regime pushed, from going to war over Iraq's non-existent weapons of mass destruction, to its plan to gut and privatize Social Security, facts were whatever Bush, Cheney, Rummy, Rove, and Condi imperiously declared them to be. More ironic, and even insulting, is the centerpiece of the library's attempt to whitewash George's 8 awful years, an interactive exhibit called Decision Points Theater. And theater it is, portraying George heroically as the decider on such big moments as Hurricane Katrina and the Wall Street collapse. Visitors to this rigged exhibit can use touch screens to see Bush getting contradictory advice, then taking a bold stand. The whole show is meant to make you feel sympathy for him. Then you're asked to vote on whether he did the right thing. Again, irony. We the people got no vote on these issues back when it would have mattered. This is Jim Hightower saying George's library is as big a fraud as his presidency was.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Fuzzy math. It's fuzzy math. Fuzzy math. I'm practicing fuzzy math. Go on, Anthony, to fudge the numbers and not tell the truth. For diplomacy to be effective, lies must be credible.
Welcome back to the show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Of course, if you have something on your mind, you can email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com, or give us a call, 1-8-5-20-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Also, Facebook, Twitter, all of those wonderful things as well. You can find it at the website. I love the Corbett position, which is he doesn't believe in statistics. Just doesn't do it. But I look at a Quinnipiac poll that shows that, well, we have seen through. In fact, his job performance numbers, disapproval, 47 to 38. Fourth straight month with a negative rating. If you look at all of the Democratic field, all of them, they all beat him. Sestak has by far the biggest lead, because I think Sestak's got the name, because he was the guy who ran in 2010. He's not even in the race, and he's beating Corbett. Allison Schwartz is beating him. Rob McCord, who isn't even in the race, is beating him. It's, you know, it's so bad that there's part of me that thinks Corbett is going to do everything he can do just to lose. He knows he's going to be a one-term governor. What the heck? Just let it out there. The reality, you look at the female vote in this state, 2-1 margin. 2-1 margin oppose him being reelected. 54%? No, absolutely not. 27%? Oh, he's our guy. Men, a little more favorable. Men are only opposed to him 46-39%. And, you know, you look at these numbers, and they're well deserved. Because you ask the question, what has he done? Well, I mean, he's gone after the GOP austerity. He's bought into it. If we can cut, you know, never mind those people at the bottom. Yeah, they don't have lobbyists. They're not going to affect me. They don't make campaign contributions. It's not going to affect me. So he's kicked the people at the bottom. He's kicked the guy while he's down, which does not surprise me. But I ask, you know, what good has he done? And I got an email during the break. You know, someone asked me, what would I do differently? Fine. You don't agree with what he's done. What would you do differently? And I think that's a very, very simple question, because it comes down to priorities. And you look at the budget that's coming up here in the budget fight coming up until the end of June. There's part of me thinks it's going to go longer, because as I'm hearing it, they haven't even held any real substantive meetings or discussions on what the budget's going to look like, other than that thing that Corbett rolled out that, I don't know, is that really a budget? I don't know. What I would have done, total different set of priorities. Those 20,000 education professionals, they'd still be on the job. The public sector workers that we need to do all kinds of jobs, the 100 and some that are going to be canned from working in labor and industry, you keep them on the job. You make government efficient. You make it responsive to people's need, instead of doing everything that they've done, which is to try and destroy it and try and hamper it. These are people who don't believe in it. So is it any surprise that when they take control, it doesn't work? Absolutely no. So I would invest heavily in education. I would invest in healthcare. The smart stuff, like keeping people in their homes, making sure that the disabled and the elderly have access to people coming to their homes and helping them stay, because I know that saves us money on the long haul. It costs us a couple pennies up front, keeping all those people employed, keeping all those people in their home. But you know what? It's a good thing. It's a smart thing. It's good policy. It's sound investment. And it's good for people. So beyond that, you start talking about infrastructure. You start talking about the future. You repair our roads and our bridges. You build broadband access in all of the communities in this state. Much like they did telephones and electricity and plumbing, that was all government investment. And I'm amazed that I live in an area that, had it not been for the electrification during the Truman years, had it not been for all of the investment put in during the Roosevelt years, we'd still be, well, hell, there's a place down in Lancaster. Guy's got an outhouse. They're saying, no, not. They're saying, well, you got to have at least a septic tank. But we'd still be living in the dark ages. Oh, no, Rick, no. somebody would do it. If government didn't have to, it would be, you know, private investors would come in. Keep telling yourself that. So I would be invested heavily in infrastructure, heavily in public transportation. Because, look, the population is not going to shrink anytime soon. People need to get around. And our infrastructure has been built on a 1970s kind of, we've been obsolete for some time. Try any major city at rush hour. Well, not any major city. Try Harrisburg at rush hour. Try getting through Carlisle during rush hour. And for me, build public transportation so that people get off the roads. Still rebuild the ones we've got. Start keeping up with demographics. Smart stuff. But build public transportation. That puts people back to work. And how do you pay for it, Rick? How do you pay for all that? That's a lot of money you're spending. How do you pay for it? Well, I start off by closing the Delaware loophole. And really closing it. Not through some sham, but actually close it. Say, look, you know, here's the tax rate. You're going to do business here? You got to pay the damn tax rate. I wouldn't try to close our gap by selling off state assets. That's dumb. But we've got a governor who thinks, hey, yeah, let's sell stuff off. Fire sale. That's going to cost us more jobs. So the more jobs governor is really the cost us more jobs governor. And that's just the start of what I would do. I would not be giving away huge tax breaks to corporations. I wouldn't be giving huge handouts. What I'd be telling them is, look, we're going to give you business. I'm not going to give you a subsidy. Are you insane? I'm going to give you money just for being here and get really nothing out of it. I mean, that's really the screwed up incentive that we've given these big companies to hold states hostage, to hold the country hostage, really. We're pitting one state against another for, hey, let's see how much we can screw out of the state taxpayers. And when they get it out of the state, then they go down to the local level. I look at where I grew up, you know, where I went to high school in Brooklyn, Ohio. American Greetings was the big company there. What they do, they shook the state down for in excess of $100 million. Because, well, we're going to move to Kentucky or we're going to move somewhere else because they're offering us a good deal. And then when they got the in excess of $100 million that they took from education and everything else, they went to the local government level, told the city, hey, well, we need tax breaks. We need money from you. And then they started shaking down the little municipalities until they got a boatload of cash. This is what we've allowed big businesses to do. And what's it done? It's caused us to have a crumbling infrastructure and an education system that's defunded. Is that the America you want to live in? And for me, I guarantee as we move across the country in our history tour, as we move across the country discovering what's going on in this country, we're going to discover exactly what's going on here is going on in every state because the wealth class, they figured out the game. They've rigged the game. And it's you and I, people like us, we're the ones who get screwed. And I'm telling you, we had better stand up and say no more, or we're going to be a third world country. Gonna take a quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death, no one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Earth, sky.
White dwarfs are the hot, dense remnants of long-dead stars.
They're the stellar cores left behind after a star has exhausted its fuel supply and blown its bulk of gas and dust into space. These exotic objects mark the final stage of evolution for most stars in the universe, including our sun.
White dwarfs are tough to find because they're small. A white dwarf with the mass of our sun would be no bigger than Earth. And as we stand on Earth and look up, we can't see a single white dwarf in the sky with the eye alone. But there are many white dwarfs around us in space.
White dwarfs are born when a star shuts down. A star spends most of its life in a precarious balance between inward pulling gravity and outward pushing gas pressure. The pressure comes from the burning of atomic fuel in the star's interior. As the star ages, it first becomes a red giant, but eventually its outer layers slough off into space, leaving behind the star's core. The exposed core is the newly born white dwarf.
The white dwarf now has before it a long, quiet future. As the trapped heat trickles out, it slowly cools and dims. Eventually, it will become an inert lump of carbon and oxygen floating in space. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Bird. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
We now have more than 2,500 survivors who have been rescued by our rescuers, by our forces who have been working in this area relentlessly for over all these nights, throughout nights and days.
We need a movement that defies every kind of inequality, one that empowers the poor and the poor, one that battles women and men.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Today, May Day, would have been Mother Jones' 183rd birthday. And, you know, she's famous for the quote, mourn the dead and fight like hell for the living. And, I look at what's been going on, and, you know, that's a pretty apt sentiment. When you look at more than 400 workers have been confirmed dead and hundreds more injured from last Wednesday's building collapse in Bangladesh. And then you add this to the 112 garment workers who were killed in the Tazreen fashion factory fire and the, more than 40, 41, 42 fires since that's happened that have killed 9 more workers, injuring countless numbers of other ones. You have to ask, are neoliberal trade policies the root of this carnage? Is there something that we should be doing, or is this going to be our destiny? And here to help me answer some of the questions and talk about what's going on in Bangladesh is Alonzo Susan. He is with the Bangladeshi country director of the Solidarity Center. He is in Bangladesh. Alonzo, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you. Good evening there, Rick.
So I look at this, Alonzo, and, at the beginning, the foreign minister there, the Bangladeshi foreign minister said they've saved some 2,500 people. But you still got in excess of 400 people who were killed in this. Can you tell me who are the rescuers? What conditions? What are we seeing right now?
Well, the rescuer was different people. The first of all, a lot of people from the neighborhood just automatically went there and started rescuing. A lot of youths went there. The army, the different defense forces, the police. So it was basically led by the army. But there was a lot of volunteers. There was a lot of assistance. I was just at a hospital yesterday, and what they told me that they don't need any more blood because so many responded in giving blood.
Good, good. You know, but I read a story that said, you know, the conditions of looking for these people, there's no equipment to dig through the rubble to rescue people. The people were actually using their bare hands to rip
yes.
through the concrete and rip through the rubble to find people.
Yes, that's true. People just without no experience in doing this kind of work, just by their hands, using hammers, using their strength in pulling up some concrete.
So at this moment, what are the workers doing? I've heard reports, I've seen reports of skirmishes breaking out. What's the scene as you see it?
The spontaneous anger, because the workers don't have any union in the garment industry. So workers have essentially done a lot of spontaneous action when they feel that they're being belittled. So in this situation, the anger that they feel that they're so vulnerable, and so it's spontaneous going out of workers from different factories for 4 or 5 days. And some of them will be basically blocking streets, destroying some establishments, burning some factory, but those are real anger, demanding that more safety be done at the workplace.
Let me ask you this, Alonzo. And
but the real problem here, Rick, is that workers do not have a union at the workplace.
Right. Well, let me ask you this. You know, what are the laws like in Bangladesh? And are there more, are there calls for more laws, more stronger laws? I mean, here in the U.S., we've got laws, but I think we also have a serious problem. And as you point out, you don't have union rights there, but I would argue here in the U.S., we really don't much either, because we see these, not to this extent, but we see on-the-job injuries. We see death on the job. Just recently, the fertilizer facility in West Texas exploded. So, you know, are we looking to our future and what's going on there in Bangladesh?
Well, I think we have an opportunity here, Rick. For a long time, brands have been calling for auditing. They've been calling for corporate social responsibility. They've been calling for this safety, but they have not been calling to ensure that freedom of association does take hold. And that's very important. If the brands start also pushing that, if workers being able to have union, then that will be a leverage. Because without a union at the workplace, there is no workers' voice participating in making sure that safety and work conditions does happen. Everything is being done top down,
right.
And it is basically a show.
Well, for me, Alonzo.
So social auditing. There's social auditing. They check to make sure that there's no child labor. But I think they also need to call for the making sure that the implementation of freedom association do happen in this country.
Right. I mean, for me, as I've been saying for the longest time, unless you have workplace democracy, unless you have a voice on the job, you can't have a voice in society or in any functional democracy either. And that's just for people here in the U.S.
That's right.
Because I look at this plant in West Texas, and if these workers would have had a voice on the job, if they would have had the ability to say, no, we're not going into this, no, we're not going to allow it to happen, much like Bangladesh, because as I understand it, and maybe you can speak to this, the workers, they didn't want to go in. They were forced to go into that
building.
That's
right. That's right. In fact, when I was talking to a young woman, she was 16 years old. Her right hand was amputated in the hospital bed. They asked her, what happened? Said, you know, were you forced to go to work? Said, no, I was not forced to go to work, but what they told me, if I don't go to work, I'm going to lose my monthly wage. So even though in her mind it wasn't forced, the threat of losing her wage made her go to work, and she lost her right hand in the incident.
So what's going to happen to her?
She was only 16.
What's going to happen to her now?
I mean, this, she was trapped, and so they had to cut her hand to free her up. And this was the hospital close to the building. It actually admitted about 1,396 workers. They did discharge 600 workers. There's about 600 workers that left, and about close to 30 people that were amputated, either losing both legs or both hands, and some are still unconscious.
And where do the
products... What's sickening is that politicians were there just taking photo ops.
That doesn't surprise me, Alonzo. But, you know, here's the thing. You know, where do the products that these workers make, where do they go?
The main product at this factory goes to a European market. Most of the brands of the what they produce are European brands. The market for Bangladeshi goods is essentially to Europe and the U.S.
You know, I saw the Pope said that, you know, it's slave labor, what's going on over there. When you work for $38 a month, there's something seriously wrong with this. When you have the Pope coming out and saying that there's something wrong, the hope I have is that, you know, people around this world look at this situation and go, not in our backyard, but here's my problem, Alonzo. You know, I had a conversation with somebody who said, well, it's a third world country. And I guess my first question is, the Bangladeshi society, where do you put that in the history of the U.S.? Because, you know, I have people say, well, it's the 1880s. It's, you know, where in U.S. history would Bangladesh be? Because a lot of people I talk to, they think it's just a third world country where there's really no wealth. I'm curious what you see.
You have a country, a small country with about 150 or more million of population. So you have it's a well-developed country, but also you have extreme poverty. In fact, though, even though the wages are low, it actually changed the dynamic for a lot of women because it gets them out of a semi-feudal cultural. So now you have more women working, making some earnings. Though even that small amount of money, it helps the family. Now the question is, because the growth of the industry has been so fast, and there are also a number of factories that totally, so what happened, there's need to be an evening of the playing field here where compliance factory need to get more orders and rewarded and they expand, and those non-compliance factory essentially close down. Because people, the competition for the prices, basically they're going down the bottom, and then you have brands that are pushing for cheaper prices and on-time delivery, forcing factory owners to cut costs. So the rule of law is very important. All those in terms of cutting down the subcontractors, very important. But essentially, without a worker's voice, all of this thing will essentially die down when the as time goes on and the Rana building situation is forgotten, the Stashroom fire is forgotten. I mean, it's not new that buildings have collapsed. You have an industry zone that are built on reclaimed land, so it's very soft ground.
Right.
And so buildings, construction of buildings, 8 stories, which is illegal, are cropping up because people, there's a need for space.
Let me ask you this, Alonzo, as someone who's in Bangladesh and sees this stuff firsthand, there's this right-wing neoliberal view that no matter what the conditions in those factories are, no matter how low the wages and how exploitative the situation is and how dangerous the situation is, it's good for them. It's good for everybody. It's good for us in the U.S. because we get cheap products. It's good for them because, you know, they'd be just standing around otherwise. I'm curious how the people in Bangladesh feel. Do they feel better off? And I guess the other question is, what would they be doing if the factory wasn't there?
Well, So on the one hand, there is a need. People in Bangladesh basically say, yes, we do need this work, but we need this work with dignity. It has to be with respect. And that's why you have this outburst of spontaneous anger.
Right. Well, there's only so much of you know what people are willing to eat. It appears our connection is broken. But, you know, I look at this, and you know, the reality is, and while Alonzo has painted a very disturbing picture, there's this view out there that, you know, these people would be that much better off, and I was hoping that he'd be able to answer that. But there's this view that, you know, since we, no matter how exploitative, how dangerous, how ugly the conditions, it's still better for them because they'd be doing nothing else. And I agree with Alonzo when he said, you know, you got women out of this semi-feudal environment, gave them opportunity to do some other things, much like the microloan movement did a couple of years back to give them sewing machines and get them to be small business people, so that they could have a little productive ability. The problem is that you have laws that are so weak, so exploitative. These big companies have so much power and so much resource. This is where I say what we need to be doing is having much, much stronger laws, much stronger zoning, much stronger rights to organize labor. And you know what? The people who do this stuff, we lock them up, we throw them in jail, much like the guy in West Texas who knew that was an unsafe thing. You put him in jail. Alonzo, I'm glad you're back, because one of the questions that I had was, you know, the people who own this factory, the people who are responsible for this, are these people going to go to jail?
I hope so. There needs to be an example. No employer has been to jail in Bangladesh since problems of fire. In fact, the industry association protects the member. I know there's going to be some debates within the industry itself. I'm hopeful that the people that are complying will take the lead in questioning and stronger regulation amongst the membership. It's important because ultimately the improvement of the workers' situation, the improvement in terms of the wages will be able to spread around in society, and that's how the society would move up. So it cannot be completely on the bottom line, because if it's, you know, that's why the neoconservative is saying, then the question is, how would the country move up? And that would only be with workers really having a voice in improving the situation and living conditions.
You know, I look at the Bangladeshi, their GDP, their economy, and you look at the apparel industry, where 78% of the country's, export revenue is from garments, from apparel, from this textile industry. And, you know, I guess the fear would be that if they dared give workers the right to have some say and to say, I'm not going into a building with huge cracks in it, that they would just move somewhere else. And I guess my question comes back to, we in the U.S. and people in Europe, in the developed world, if you will, isn't it our laws that have encouraged this? Isn't it our trade policy that's allowed this to happen? And shouldn't we be saying, you know what, in order to sell in our markets, you've got to respect workers, you've got to pay them a reasonable wage, and make sure that buildings don't collapse on them?
Yes, yes. That's very important. That's very important. He said about the competition, well, the customer, there's some saying, well, the customer pays the price, and then you have a more expensive shirt and less expensive shirt. Customer goes to the less expensive
shirt. I'm okay with that, Alonzo.
Shirt.
I'm willing to pay an extra couple of pennies
that's the thinking. But then what we're calling, you know, a penny a shirt going to help and build up or ensure that those goes to the improvement of the regulation will make a big difference.
I'm okay paying an extra couple
of pennies. It does not increase the price of the good.
It just may decrease a little bit of the profit margin, and heaven forbid that we decrease the profit margin for the global wealth class.
Well, that's the Walmart's thinking, right?
Yeah. But Alonzo, I appreciate you taking time for me. I appreciate the information on this. Thanks so much, and I hope that you'll come back and talk to us again and tell us how this thing's moving forward.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you for inviting me, and I hope sometimes we can be able to get a Bangladeshi worker in life.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to
The Rana building.
I absolutely want that, Alonzo.
And I think it's important that the American people hear their voice themselves.
Thanks so much. Alonzo Susan, the director of the Bangladesh Solidarity Center from there. I mean, just what a horrible tragedy. Lessons have to be learned. And as Mother Jones said, mourn for the dead, but fight like hell for the living. And not just in Bangladesh, but also here in the U.S. Quick break, right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Stop the talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
On December 28, 1970, President Richard Nixon signed the Occupational Safety and Health Act into law. Thanks to strong lobbying efforts by union leaders over many years, this safety bill of rights established for the first time a comprehensive national policy to protect workers' health and safety. Effective April 28, 1971, employers were required to provide a workplace free of known hazards that caused or were likely to cause serious physical injury or death. Prior to the passage of OSHA, work-related injuries and deaths were extremely high. The 1920s saw reports of 20,000 workers killed on the job and more than 2.5 million injured per year. That number remained until the 1960s when work-related deaths dropped to 14,000 per year, but injuries increased by 20%. Today, thanks to OSHA, protections on-the-job injuries have fallen 40% and on-the-job deaths have been reduced by 60% pre-OSHA. OSHA is considered the first piece of legislation allowing the government to inspect and hold employers accountable for dangerous and physically harmful working conditions. OSHA has three branches, an enforcement branch, a research branch, and a review branch. Since its passage, OSHA has allowed for greater visibility and oversight in conditions on the job, prioritizing efforts to prevent accidents, control health hazards, and ensure workers go home as safe and as healthy as when they arrived on the job. While OSHA is a step in the right direction, there is still considerable work to be done, and only through the eyes and voices of working people with the help of their unions will tomorrow be a safer day. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therichsmithshow.com.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. You know, I listened to that, and, you know, horrible tragedy. But one that, again, you look at all of these situations, could have been avoided. Proper construction, proper zoning, proper oversight, and more important than anything to me, is those people who, those more than 3,100 people who walked into that building going, we know this is unsafe, but we can't make it a day without without the pennies that we're being paid. We can't lose a day's pay. And we can't afford, to, if the boss fires us, to lose our job. Can't. So we have to put our lives in peril. We have to put ourselves in this position. And to have no voice, to me, that's the biggest indignity of all. And the sad reality is it isn't much better here in the U.S. It's just we got a court system. We might be able to sue years down the road. You got a little safety net. You get hurt on the job. Maybe you'll get workman's comp. Maybe. But we've all got it in our mind. Oh, the laws are there to protect us until you get yourself into that situation. And I look at this thing in West Texas. You know, those people had to know it. We're trying to find one, a worker to come and talk to us. And when we go down on our tour to look at this, we're going to try and find people. Because you had to know there was something wrong. Because the workers, the person right there looking at, the person who knows the job, the person who's right there on the front, they know. And to not give them the ability, the voice, the say, it's just dumb. And, you know, I never understood why you wouldn't want that, why you wouldn't demand it. I look at this report from North Carolina. In 2012, North Carolina, the Department of Labor there in North Carolina, estimated that there were 35 workplace fatalities. Problem is, the folks at the Council for Occupational Safety and Health, they have put that number, not 35, not double at 70, not even double the 70 to 140. They put that number at 150 deaths on the job. And again, you look at all of the numbers that are out there, you look at all of the facts. For instance, there are some 50,000 people every year that die of occupational illnesses, and there's no one that keeps track of this. And for me, I look at all of the things, this thing in Bangladesh, what's going on in Texas, what's going on in places around this country, and you gotta wonder, what more is it going to take? You know, when I was driving a truck for a living, carrying a union card, I knew that if I showed up to work and the brakes were out of alignment or there was a tire that had a bald spot in it that could blow, that there was something wrong, I had the backing to say no. The greatest strength a worker has is the strength to fold their arms and say no. I'm not doing it. I'm not putting myself at risk. I'm not putting my family at risk. It's a powerful thing. Sad story there in Bangladesh, though. The sad reality is, unless they do something, it's probably going to happen again. And that's what's seriously, seriously wrong. Going to take a quick break. Right back with hour three of the program. If you missed any portion of the program, the podcast, they're at therickSmithShow.com or get the Stitcher app. Take the program on the go. Quick break. Right back.
Thought back to America. Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Warehouse Workers United's Elizabeth Brennan says that Walmart refused to accept petitions calling for the reinstatement of worker activist Javier Rodriguez. Rodriguez was fired from a Walmart warehouse in California's Inland Empire last Thursday.
They invented a reason to demote him last Friday, and then on Thursday, just a few days ago, they called him into the office, said they had conducted an investigation of which he wasn't part of and told him that he was fired, that he should get his things and leave. So we immediately launched a petition and got the word out about this, and the response has been really overwhelming. We're asking that he be reinstated to his job as a forklift driver at this warehouse, and we're directing that to Walmart. They hold all the cards in this situation.
Brennan says workers formed Warehouse Workers United to fight to improve bad working conditions in the warehouses that ship Walmart goods to the stores. Brennan says Javier Rodriguez was fired for his labor organizing and activism to improve working conditions, and Walmart is responsible.
He works in 100% Walmart contracted warehouse, so everything they touch ends up on the shelves of Walmart. Last year, he started organizing with his coworkers to improve the working conditions. They were facing extreme temperatures over 100 degrees, lots of dust, broken equipment, high rates of injury. Sometimes they didn't have access to drinking water. And he and a bunch of his coworkers went out on strike. They don't have the protection of a union. They're incredibly courageous and brave.
The United Mine Workers of America rallied more than 6,000 people in St. Louis Monday in the latest round of the union's battle to preserve promised health care benefits for retired miners and their dependents. Peabody Coal spun off a company called Patriot Coal. Now Patriot is in bankruptcy court, where a decision will be made about the company effort to deprive miners of those promised benefits. 16 people were arrested at the rally on Monday. The U.S. may not be as short on tech workers as some CEOs would have us believe. Jesse Russell reports.
The IT industry is pushing for an immigration bill that would allow for more work visas for foreign workers with specialized skills. A new report by the Economic Policy Institute finds that the country already has a surplus of domestic workers skilled in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. According to the report, for every two U.S. graduates with an IT-related degree, only one is hired in the industry. Of those IT graduates who weren't hired into their field, 32% said it was because they couldn't find a job, and 53% said there were better opportunities outside of the IT industry. One of the key findings is that wages in the industry have stagnated at the 1990 levels. The report hypothesizes that the amount of foreign-born IT workers in the country on visas has deflated wage growth in the sector.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
And the radio is in the hands of such a lot of fools trying to anesthetize the way that you
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So today, back in 1886, in cities like Chicago and Los Angeles and places all across this country, hundreds of thousands of workers took to the streets to begin the tradition known as May Day, the demonstration for an eight-hour day. You know, the thing that we take for granted today, it's all these benevolent employers, they give us this stuff. Well, you know, this is something that people fought, bled, and died for. Took generations to get. But yet, you know, we seem to think, well, you know, these benevolent corporations give us wonderful things. Which is why on this May Day, it's important to remember our past, what it took to get here, which is why I've asked Larry Spivak, president of the Illinois Labor Historical Society, to come talk to us about May Day and, well, the events that transpired just afterwards. Larry, thanks for taking time for me.
Good evening.
You know, again, I go back to this day in 1886, hundreds of thousands of people out into the streets to fight for this eight-hour day, and I look to today. We need to have that kind of organization going on right now, I believe.
Well, we certainly do. We've had about a 35-year decline of a standard of living of American workers, the richest nation on earth, and it's always because the corporate agenda has controlled everything about our economy, and if workers are able to realize their power, we can change that.
Take me back to 1886. You know, today back then, you had this, what was to begin the tradition of May Day as an international labor holiday. In the days after, there was the Haymarket Massacre. Walk me through that time period.
Pardon me?
Walk me through the time period after May Day in 1886, the Haymarket Affair, some of the history behind that.
Sure. Well, in 1884, the group that actually became the AFL, the Federation of Trades and Labor Unions, called for a national strike to be, that all workers should be out on strike by May 1st of 1886. And by May 1st of 1886, 350,000 workers were on strike, one-fourth of them in Chicago, because Chicago was the fastest growing city in the country, industrial. And so it's important to understand the context of the time, that this is not, it wasn't a one-time thing, that for the last 20 years of the Civil War, wages had been driven down and there had been depressions, and that it really the same notion of today, corporate greed was the rule of the day. So it was a time of there was a class struggle that was apparent to rich people, and it was the idea that 8 hours of work for the typical 10, 12, or 14 hours of work should be the same pay, but for 8 hours of work was revolutionary. And in certain ways, it's ironic because the average family today works 4,000 hours a year to get the average family income that would it took 2,000 hours just 40 years ago. Yeah. So it's almost back to this period of that Gilded Age of the 1886.
Well, the reason I bring this up is because, you know, I think this exact fight has to be relived again, to where we go, hey, instead of a 40-hour work week, let's talk about a 32 or a 24-hour work week to be able to support and a family and to live.
Yeah.
I think that same battle has to be fought again.
Well, it's being fought again, except that the fight again is for a 40-hour week, and that's the irony of it. But that being the case, you cannot live in a society and have a middle class when 1% of the population has 70 or 80% of the wealth. And American workers, not being aware of their history, just accept the fact, I guess. And there's a great deal of organization taking place trying to change that consciousness. I don't know that we'll get to the point of a 32-hour week, but we certainly have to look at the fact that this stratification of wealth is just destroying the standard of living of average working people. Children get out of college and live at home until they're 30 years old, 32 years old, and at the same time we denigrate people who become teachers and become public employees. And unfortunately, both parties seem to want to support that notion.
Yeah, you brought up an interesting point about labor history because, you know, we're doing this labor history tour in June across the country because my kids, they don't get any of it. And, in fact, the vast majority of kids in this country get nothing about labor history. We teach our kids nothing. And I think that's on purpose. It's by design so that we don't look to the past.
Rick, you don't even need to think. That's the censorship of the corporate agenda of the past. What you do is you erase the history of people. You erase it, and they do not know where they came from or what they do. That's the purpose of the Illinois Labor History Society, to help people understand that. My experience is that when people learn that history, they become angry, they become conscious, and they want to do something. But and so you can understand that if you're wealthy and you control all the media, you control all information, you're going to make sure that nobody understands that.
Well, take me back to 1886, because right now we are living what most economists are saying is in one of the most unequal times in our country's history, where the very wealthy have so much and the folks at the bottom have, well, virtually nothing. What were the conditions back in 1886, and are they similar today, or is the inequality worse? What would be the difference other than?
Well, I don't think you could say the inequality is worth. We certainly have, one out of five children live in poverty. I mean, that's unconscionable. We're 19th in the world in terms of education when it comes to certain tests of academic skill. We have the worst labor laws of any developed nation in the world, and those are indicators of a failing society where we built this incredible middle class. I don't think we can say, and I'm not going to be romantic about the fact that, if that it's exactly the same as 1886. In 1935, we passed labor law legislation. We passed the Fair Labor Standards Act in 1938, and we passed Social Security. There are a lot of things. There is a minimal social safety net that people have, and that's part of the problem, which is in the 1930s, they had nothing.
Right.
In the 1880s, they had nothing, and so the fight was more desperate. Now people just sort of live at a kind of a minimal standard of acquiescence to the system of degradation, which doesn't have to be that way, but it's a race to the bottom because corporate America has decided that this need for profit that has always been the case of the system is insatiable. And so, workers have gone for 35 years without an increase in pay, and people begin to just accept that.
Yeah, in fact, the pay has gone backwards, and I talk all the time. When I first started in the trucking business, I was making $14 an hour back in the late 80s. Doing the same job today, they're making about $11.80 right now. That's in real,
right.
In actual dollars. That's not adjusted for anything. That's just how work has slid backwards. And I had hoped that this president would be the guy who would save work by passing something as weak and as minimal as the Employee Free Choice Act, I thought was.
Well, I have to tell you something. The Employee Free Choice Act isn't even on the agenda because corporate America runs both parties. And that is something that would mean that workers would have a right to organize. If American workers had the right to organize like they did in the 1930s when tens of millions of people joined unions and created a middle class, when the government said, Franklin Roosevelt said, if I worked in a factory, I would belong to a union. That is an anathema to corporate America. We're not going to get that right now, given the current administration, given a corporate hierarchy, if you want to call it that, that basically controls all aspects of our lives. And it's up to people, working class, middle class, whatever we want to use, whatever term we want to use, to understand that they have an incredible amount of power, and they do. And that's partly what this fight over this May Day has been in the last few May Days, because there's 11 to 13 million immigrants that live in this country who, and, you know, 65% of Americans have been polled said they'd belong to a union if they could, but only 12% of workers, 11.5% are in a union, and 50% of those are in public sector organizations. So only 1 out of 17 workers in the private sector is in a union, because it's basically criminal activity for corporate America, because they do not want the workers to have any say in the workplace.
Yeah. And last line of question, because I was going to ask you about the immigration issue, because I know in 2006 on May Day, there were hundreds of thousands of people in places like New York and Chicago and Los Angeles,
mm-hmm.
and all across this
right.
country. For me, the immigration issue is nothing new. This is the cycle that's continually been used against working people to keep us divided. It's always been race.
It's interesting that you say that, because in 1886, 1 out of 3 Chicagoans were German-speaking. They were despised because they had come to this country in large numbers to escape Bismarck's Germany. Many of them had been union-oriented, and the native-born Americans and the business class fought them and created this hatred of Germans, and that's why the Haymarket tragedy occurred, because it was easy to say that 7 of the 8 Haymarket martyrs were German-born, and therefore they were awful people. Today in Chicago, 1 out of 3 people are Spanish-speaking, and it's the same issue. It's always been an issue of America's, except for African-Americans that were chained, enslaved, and forced here. The rest of the country are immigrants, and people come here because corporations want their cheap labor, and then they want to send them back after they've used them up in the meatpacking plants and the small factories and the industry that exists today. It's but the bigger issue, and also the issue that gives us optimism, is that capital is global in a way that it's never been. And workers are beginning to organize on this aspect that was something that was thought about in 1886, the idea that International Labor Day should come out of the struggle of the Haymarket Martyrs of 1886. And there's a holiday in almost every country in the world except the United States, despite the fact that the events that took place were in Chicago in 1886.
Yeah, because it's those communists, Larry. It's the communist holiday, I'm told.
A communist holiday. Well, as Mother Jones said in 1930 when she was about to die, she said, "They call me a Bolshevik, they call me a communist. I accept whatever they accuse me of because I believe that working people have the right to dignity, the right to have their labor respected." And so, but it's a silly idea. You know, the British, the Italians, the Spanish, the Dutch, the Argentinians, those aren't communist countries. I don't think there is a communist country. There's never been a communist country. That's just a part of the Cold War to keep workers from being able to organize.
And to keep us divided.
That's just semantics.
And that's the hope on a day like today, that we see some unity, we see some solidarity. And I know in Chicago there are a bunch of activities there around the country. There are a bunch of people coming together, although our media is not really going to report much about that.
This is this idea of May Day being reclaimed is really interesting because organized labor has now finally said that, you know, May Day is a holiday that belongs to Americans. As we were talking about, it's belonged to everybody else because of the events in Chicago. And organized labor is finally realizing that the only way to succeed is to organize the unorganized, which happen to be large numbers of immigrants, the ability to drive down wages, whether you go to Bangladesh, as an example, or somewhere else to make things, or to bring in immigrant labor to drive down the wages of is the way to make profit. And that is the basis of which unions organized in the first place. That is a crime against humanity. That is a humanitarian issue when you say that workers should not be paid the value of what they create. And so this is an opportunity that people are beginning to seize upon and see that when you have CEOs making 700, 800 or 1,000 times, 20, 30, 40, $100 million a year at the expense of people who are workers who make can't even make a living wage. The average wage in American worker is less than $30,000 a year. The average family income, which is almost 4,000 hours of work a year, is less than $50,000 a year. It's incomprehensible. And so this is what we're dealing with, and whether or not American workers can come to understand that their solidarity is what's going to make a difference is the question that faces all of us.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and I hope that we see you when we're in Chicago for our history tour, because I think this is a message that has to be taken across the country, and we look forward to being in Chicago, and I hope to see you.
Well, you will, and the Illinois Labor History Society is going to continue to preserve the message, and as the owner of the Haymarket Martyrs Monument, we are always showing people that the international labor movement began in Chicago. It's an American holiday. It's that's what patriotism is. It's about defending workers' rights. You cannot have a democracy without workers having the right to strike, without workers having a basic dignity of life, a free education, free health care. That is what a democracy is. And when American workers and begin to understand that they don't have to be ruled by 1% of the population, we will see significant changes, and that's what we're about.
I'm right there with you, brother. Happy May Day to you. Thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it, Larry.
Well, thank you very much. Happy May Day to you.
Larry Spivak, president of the Illinois Labor History Society, illinoislaborhistory.org, the website. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the top.
Together, we can. can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Gosh, it seems like only yesterday that we saw George W. on TV reading The Pet Goat to some second graders. But now, he's all grown up and has an entire super-duper king-size library filled with big books and other neat stuff, all dedicated to him. Bush's Pharaonic Presidential Center is now open, allowing us commoners to dig deep into the shallowness of his achievements. The enormous building itself sets the tone. Sharp edges, high brick walls, and the welcoming feel of a fortress. Yet, the ex-pres insists that it's a place for public contemplation of his legacy. Quote, a place to lay out facts. How ironic is that? After all, the Bush-Cheney regime was infamous for its disregard of facts, as well as its constant hiding, twisting, and wholesale manufacturing of facts to fool the people. On everything the regime pushed, from going to war over Iraq's non-existent weapons of mass destruction, to its plan to gut and privatize Social Security, facts were whatever Bush, Cheney, Rummy, Rove, and Condi imperiously declared them to be. More ironic, and even insulting, is the centerpiece of the library's attempt to whitewash George's 8 awful years, an interactive exhibit called Decision Points Theater. And theater it is, portraying George heroically as the decider on such big moments as Hurricane Katrina and the Wall Street collapse. Visitors to this rigged exhibit can use touchscreens to see Bush getting contradictory advice, then taking a bold stand. The whole show is meant to make you feel sympathy for him. Then you're asked to vote on whether he did the right thing. Again, irony. We the people got no vote on these issues back when it would have mattered. This is Jim Hightower saying George's library is as big a fraud as his presidency was.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425, or email me, Rick, at TheRickSmithShow.com. So, the Screwquester front and center, but some Republicans think, hey, it's a great thing, we need more Screwquester. We need to screw those workers just a little bit more. And according to Missouri Republican Billy Long, things are going great. People that he's talked to, things are going well. He said, in fact, when I go out to in a restaurant here in town, people come up to me and they say they want to see more sequester, not less. They want to see more cuts. They want to see more pain and suffering. Screw those poor people. He goes on to say, I think it's different than it could be in some parts of the country, but we haven't seen any measurable effect here at all. They've seen nothing, nothing at all. Problem is you think about the Head Start programs in his community that are closing their doors. You think about the Youth Conservation Corps program that is seeing massive cuts. In fact, shut down. You see cuts that have hurt their defense. Their Fort Leonard Wood and the Whitman Air Force Base there in Missouri, they've cut their training flight time by 10%, eliminated non-essential travel, frozen civilian pay. You know what that civilian pay meant? No money in the community. Head Start, you name it, job training programs, you name it, cuts, 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 but nothing that he sees. No, nothing. And, you know, you remember being up in the Scranton area, where Congressman Cartwright, the Democrat up in that area, had a rally to highlight the fact that you've got Toby Hanna, who's got some 5,600 workers who are going to see a pretty sizable chunk of their paychecks extracted from them, well, ripped off. Same thing in Missouri. There are going to be 8,000 civilian defense employees to be furloughed. In fact, they're saying somewhere in the neighborhood of $40 million in lost wages. Guess where that money used to go? It used to go into the local economy. Something seriously, seriously wrong and really kind of insane about this whole thing. Just plain nuts in my view. And then you've got Frank Lewis, Republican from Oklahoma, House Agriculture Committee Chairman, who, well, looking at the farm bill, ready to mark it up, got to cut those food stamps because, you know, like Governor Corbett said, you know, they're just drug addicts. They're worthless. They're lazy, right? You know, Governor Corbett said, you know what, there are employers out there that just can't find people who could pass a drug test. Same thing with those welfare people, which is why we need to drug test them. $20 billion coming from the food stamp account. They're going to cut, according to Capital Press. He's planning to cut the farm bill, $38 billion in spending over the next 10 years, with $20 billion coming from the food stamp program and $18 billion coming from the rest of the farm bill. Those cuts would include $3 billion more than those included in the farm bill passed by the committee last year. Now, understand that supplemental nutrition program, that program that helps feed people, that helped keep this country from depression after the Bush collapse. That's social safety net. So you've got the Republican view, which is screw the workers, which is take food out of the mouths of children, which is take wages from the pockets of workers, but make sure all the Delaware loopholes and all the special interest tax breaks, all that stuff right in place. Which is why I'm glad to see in New York City, for instance, there are a couple of council members, Humann Williams and Stephen Levin, who today announced a resolution calling for support for the national financial transaction tax or the Inclusive Prosperity Act, which was reintroduced, last month, in the month of April, by Keith Ellison, the Democrat from Minnesota, H.R., 1579, and this is what we've been saying for the longest time. This is going to raise, they're saying, $350 billion a year in revenue by just putting a small, reasonable sales tax on every one of those high-speed computer trades, every time a stock is traded. Minuscule. Me, I would have gone up to 0.25%. This is like 0.002% or some small, minuscule number that even Wall Street won't even go with that. Because that means their bottom line, that means their profits. You know, but that could pay for education, infrastructure, and you know what else it could do? Just a thought. Could stop some of the speculation. It's not going to stop it because it's not large enough. But for me, this should be the first club out of the bag. Instead of taking food out of the mouths of children, instead of taking wages out of the pockets of workers, instead of making conditions worse for everybody else, maybe our wealthy friends, just a little help. I know. But Rick, they pay all the taxes now already. Keep telling yourself that. Keep buying the right-wing corporate line. It's not true. but you can keep buying it. Anyway, I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Smith Show.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So some interesting stuff coming out around this basketball player, Jason Collins, who came out this week, being gay, and who, I don't really care, but it is big news. The first pro athlete who's still in the game to come forward. A lot of interesting comments from other athletes. The ESPN guys, kind of gave sort of a half-hearted, well, not really an apology, for some of the nonsense that they said. And I look at this story from Wisconsin, one of these Wisconsin church groups who had asked this former NFL player, this Leroy Butler, former Green Bay Packer, to come talk about anti-bullying. And, as soon as he came out and said that, hey, good for you, behind you, that kind of stuff. His speech was canceled. Yeah, so much for it is what it is. Anyway, let's find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the world. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, thank you very much.
So what do you think of this whole Jason Collins thing?
Well, I think it's fascinating that this kind of thing is still news,
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm at the point where in London, in the UK, is it like this? I mean, are they as insane as we are on this issue?
I think they are in football, soccer to you, in the sense that there's a lot of homophobia and racism among the fans.
Yeah.
There's nasty slurs shouted. But I don't think there is so much among the players themselves.
Yeah, I take a very libertarian view. It's none of my business. Whatever you do in the confines of your four walls with consenting adults, that's your business.
Exactly. Business.
And if you're dumb enough to enter into a legally binding contract, call it whatever the hell you want, that guarantees somebody else half your stuff, join the club. I mean, I have a friend who said, it's going to ruin the sanctity of the marriage. And I'm going, you're doing a pretty good job of destroying that sanctity yourself. And look, when the heterosexual world gets their ducks in a row and stops with the 50% divorce rate, maybe they can talk. Just maybe. Anyway, happy May Day to you.
Happy May Day, up the workers.
Yay. And Pope Francis. There may be, I was telling someone today, I wasn't hopeful, I thought maybe, you know, it's much of the same. I may at some point, if this continues, consider going back to the Catholic Church.
Well, I mean, you know, there are issues and issues, and he said a couple of very interesting things today. You know, he said, I think of how many, and not just young people, are unemployed many times due to a purely economic conception of society, which seeks selfish profit beyond the parameters of social justice. I wish to extend an invitation to solidarity to everyone. I'd like to encourage those in public office to make every effort to give new impetus to employment. That was the mild statement. The stronger one was talking about Bangladesh, calling what they earn slave labor.
Yep.
And then saying, today in the world, this slavery is being committed against something beautiful that God's given us, the capacity to create, to work, to have dignity, not paying fairly, not giving a job because you're only looking at balance sheets, only looking at how to make a profit. That goes against God.
Like I said, you know, this guy keeps on this path, I may return. Because, you know, when I was growing up, the Catholic Church was still in the peace and social justice arena. You know, how do we stop people from killing each other? And how do we make sure that people can feed their families and have some dignity in their lives? And you know, I've seen the Catholic Church, and I'm sure some people are going to argue with me, but I've seen them move away from that, where the sole focus is on abortion and, well, how much money you can put into the coffers. Now, I mean, you know, growing up as a kid in the Catholic Church, they still had the, hey, how much money can you put in the plate thing. I still remember the church calling my house every Monday morning going, hey, where's the money? Because we were poor, you know, and you had to put that envelope in the plate every week to prove you were there. We didn't have any food in the cupboard. What do you think? There was going to be money in the envelope? But they still didn't stop them from calling.
Right.
But, you know, keep this up. May consider going back. And you look at the tragedy in Bangladesh and the numerous tragedies over the last several months. 5 months ago, you had the one that killed, what, 140 people?
Yeah.
I mean, there's something seriously wrong here. And I see Democrats might actually consider something.
Well, there were a few Democrats. Representative Sandy Levin of Michigan, senior Democrat on Ways and Means. George Miller, California, who's the ranking member in the House on the Education Workforce Panel, wrote to President Obama today calling for immediate action to better protect Bangladeshi workers from Western companies that might purchase garments based solely on the cheapest price without regard to the condition under which the garments were made. What they want him to do is they want his administration to lead an effort together with the European Union to bring together key European and American retailers that have sourced from Bangladesh to adopt a common response leading to a universal standard guaranteeing basic workplace safety and fundamental worker rights.
Yeah, but no, that's not a good idea. The companies should police themselves because they do such a great job here in the U.S. They should police themselves because, you know what? It's in their it's not really in their best interest to have safe working conditions, or we wouldn't have all these disasters and all of these tragedies. And I look at in our backyard, you know, here in the U.S., the thing in West Texas, 15 people killed because, well, Texas 5 years ago decided to inspect and they fined this company. Last time they inspected it 5 years ago, fined them. How bad did it have to be 5 years ago for Texas to fine them?
Not good.
I would like to see Sanders and Sander Levin and the rest of them go, you know what? Let's protect workers here. Let's do that. Let's be the example for the world. And you know what? Have trade policies that say if you screw with your workers and you exploit them and you put them in these kind of conditions, you can't bring your stuff in here. Just my thought.
And a good thought it is, too.
Yeah. Well, but, you know, I look at this, and you look at some of the things that are going on here, and I just read this report that said, you know, there are like seven, you know, this fertilizer plant in West Texas, there are like 7,000 of those around that could impact, you know, more than a million people. And of the list of the 7,000, West Texas, that plant there wasn't even on that list. So who knows what's in our backyard? Who knows what? You know what I like? You know what I found interesting about that West Texas explosion?
What?
There was a school within 500 feet of that plant.
Yes, I know.
There was a hospital within 2,500, a nursing home within 1,000 feet. Maybe we should be talking about our own zoning regulations and our own environmental and our own health and safety regulations, too. Just a thought. So, I understand there were three more stupid people arrested in the Boston bombings.
These people are quite extraordinary. You know, you've got to wonder whether they were stupid or whether they actually know more than they're saying. Two Kazakh students and an American student, all 19, at school with Jokhar Tsarnaev, and they'd seen pictures of him, you know, and they thought, oh, it must be him. And they'd sort of exchanged texts, and he'd sort of said, yeah, you know, we're about to leave. If you need something in my room, take it. And Tatyakov, which is one of them, learned of the message, believed he'd never see Tsarnaev alive again. They went to the room, and they saw these fireworks with the gunpowder out of it, and then they knew that Tsarnaev was involved in the bombing, decided to remove the backpack in order to help him avoid trouble. And then they decided to remove Tsarnaev's laptop because they didn't want Tsarnaev's roommate to think he was stealing or behaving suspiciously by just taking the backpack. That is so illogical.
Yeah.
Because that's bigger stealing.
Yeah, I look at this, and I guess there's a couple ways. These are just really, really stupid people, or they're the sleeper cell.
I think they're really, really stupid people.
Come on, it doesn't play into the theme where we need to be cracking down on immigrants and we need to be cracking down on people. This was a sleeper cell, Victoria.
Well, I mean, I think you can crack down on people who don't abide by their student visas, which these two people possibly were, and throw them out.
I'm with
you. I have no problem with that.
I have no problem with it. And you know what? I have no problem throwing the book at stupid people. If you do stupid things like this, you need to be made the example.
I mean, this was 3 days after the bombing. They knew the impact on other human beings, and they chose to do this rather than turning what sounded like a killer of, at that time, four people and wounding all these amputees. They chose to help him out.
Yeah. Now, I've seen some reports, and maybe you can speak better than I can, but some of the DNA was supposed to be that of a female.
Yes, they found female DNA on one of the bombs. They also found a fingerprint. They've taken DNA from Catherine Russell, Tamerlan Tsarnaev's wife, and to see whether it might have been hers. We don't know anything about results of that. And obviously they're looking into other things. Now, it could be something entirely inadvertent. It could have been the person who sold it to them.
Yeah. Just a lot to this. And look, heaven forbid if you had any contact with these people. If it were me, even if I knew him just in passing, I would be going, I had nothing to do with it. Here I am. Scrutinize me as you will. I had nothing to do with it. I'm telling you everything I know.
Oh, I would be going forward and saying, you know, I met him for coffee 3 months ago, and this is what happened.
Yep. In fact, I'd be coming forward and saying, maybe I met him. He lived in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Just because once they come after you, there's trouble.
Yeah.
And a new report out on inmates dying.
This is extraordinary. This is the Department of Justice Inspector General report that came out today about the Bureau of Prisons Compassionate Release Program. It's not working too well.
Okay.
They say it's poorly managed, it's clogged with delays that have resulted in ill prisoners dying before their requests were completed. They say that the Bureau of Prisons runs a haphazard and ad hoc program to consider the compassionate release of dying inmates or prisoners who have an extraordinary and compelling situation that merits a reduction in their sentence. We're talking about people with a terminal incurable disease, right. Life expectancy 18 months, incurable progressive illness, debilitating injury from which they will not recover, completely disabled. You get the picture.
Yeah, and so my first thought on this is this a way to transfer the costs of health care from the prison industry onto the rest of society outside of the prison industry? That's my first thought. Maybe I'm cynical.
Well, I mean, that's what they are they're talking about doing that. I mean, because they, at the moment, these people are in the prison system, 218,000, and there are tens of thousands of inmates ignorant of the possibility for compassionate release because there's no formal program to educate inmates about the right of compassionate release.
Yeah. See, I thought once you went to jail, you served your sentence. And I understand the whole compassion thing. Just don't know. There's part of me that goes, this is just a push by the lobbyists to get them out into society so they die quicker because they won't have care. Just a thought.
That's a possibility.
Because, you know, what kind of job are you going to get when you get out of prison, especially if you're sick or disabled or any of that other stuff? You're going to end up on the back of Medicaid.
Yeah.
Yeah, just one of those things.
No, it's an interesting way to look at it.
And I guess the other thing you've got to look at is, you know, who are these people that are getting this compassionate release? I mean, we're not talking about, you know, axe murderers and rapists, are we?
By and large, no.
No. And finally, over in Syria, I guess something has been decided. We're going to start giving them weapons. I guess we're going to start arming the rebels. Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, Jay Carney was asked a lot of questions about that, not surprisingly, in today's briefing. And he was saying, well, we're looking at things. Nothing's changed, is basically what he was trying to say, in complete contradiction of this report that said that the United States is preparing to arm the rebels. So I think that they're walking this back. But the report was pretty specific yesterday that came out. And it cited senior administration officials. So I can't remember if it was in the Post or the Times. I think it was in the Post. I think it was in the Post, I believe.
Right.
And it sounded very credible to me. It wasn't like this ridiculous report today in the Daily Mail about Saudis and the bombings. It wasn't that. It sounded pretty credible to me. So I think, yes, I think they are considering arming the rebels because it makes sense given where they are at this point. They don't have a lot of other options.
Yeah, I wonder what the chances are that we're already doing it and it's just a way of okay, now we're going to start doing it.
Well, that's quite possible, too. We're certainly facilitating the flow of money to arm rebels.
Yeah. And again, I go back to, you know, go back to the 80s when we created Bin Laden. How long will this take to turn around and bite us on the backside?
Oh, well, there's always the law of unintended consequences.
Yeah, good point. Victoria, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate the time.
Good to talk to you. Thank you.
Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Never you will look back again. We'll fight on to the end. Together we will live on forevermore. In the plan we have defended from all things dark and cold. Now we are defenseless.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Earth, sky.
White dwarfs are the hot, dense remnants of long-dead stars.
They're the stellar cores left behind after a star has exhausted its fuel supply and blown its bulk of gas and dust into space. These exotic objects mark the final stage of evolution for most stars in the universe, including our sun.
White dwarfs are tough to find because they're small. A white dwarf with the mass of our sun would be no bigger than Earth. And as we stand on Earth and look up, we can't see a single white dwarf in the sky with the eye alone. But there are many white dwarfs around us in space.
White dwarfs are born when a star shuts down. A star spends most of its life in a precarious balance between inward pulling gravity and outward pushing gas pressure. The pressure comes from the burning of atomic fuel in the star's interior. As the star ages, it first becomes a red giant, but eventually its outer layers slough off into space, leaving behind the star's core. The exposed core is the newly born white dwarf.
The white dwarf now has before it a long, quiet future. As the trapped heat trickles out, it slowly cools and dims. Eventually, it will become an inert lump of carbon and oxygen floating in space. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Bird. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Sanity for a change. The Rick Smith Show.
Heaven knocking on the door. Me home.
Yeah, well, that's the Corbett theme song, Take Care of Their Own, the very wealthy, the very well-to-do, and the campaign contributors. Sure, take care of those folks. Sell off all of our assets. And look, his numbers are in the tank. I expect it to go into full gear, full long forward, and the sale of the wine and spirit shops. Again, I think dumb. The sale of an asset that pays dividends year after year without any guarantees that we're going to get any money, without any guarantees that prices are going to come down, workers are going to continue to have jobs. It just seems, well, it seems like ideology. And here to talk a little bit about this, our buddy Jake Long, who has been following this for quite some time. It's good to hear you back, Jake.
Well, thanks, Rick. I think there might be some ray of hope on our side, Rick. I really think Monday was a real positive for those who oppose it. My God, we could talk about for an hour the reasons not to, but there were some organizations that showed up with some clout. The Fraternal Order of Police showed up. Their spokesman, Les Neary, he talked about wanting a dedicated amount of money each year for enforcement needs, and they need to be available. There's a problem there. The Republicans have refused to allocate $1. And according to their latest report, it would cost about $15 million to the taxpayers of the state. Now, that's if it stays at $1,200, Rick, if this passes, and you and I both know. In certainly the long term, maybe even the medium term, we're going to be looking at the rearview mirror on that $1,200. I mean, who knows where that'll lead? But the State Police Association have come out and opposed it. There were some other organizations that showed up. There were two spokesmen, a Samantha Lavelle and a Dakota Donnell, that came on, and they were extremely good in their testimony. They represent statewide organizations, Rick, that deal with alcohol and drug abuse. And this is what Samantha said. Now, this is according to her. These are statistics that come from reliable sources. The difference between a regulated system and a non-regulated system is about 14.7%. So just off the bat, on average, you'll see about a 15% increase in alcohol consumption. Now, I'd like to point out that Pennsylvania is a pretty big state. It's a pretty big state, and you have a lot of people that like to drink. And if you, in fact, make it more available, who knows that 15% will stay. Now, here's an interesting statistic that Dakota Denoy brought out. According to her, and this is a quote, teenagers, because of biological makeup, are more susceptible to alcoholism. They are actually able to drink more. And cheap, easily accessible alcohol will certainly increase that problem. I think we can both relate to that. Both of us, when we were younger, we liked to imbibe alcohol. And the truth is, once these younger ones are hooked, they tend to stay hooked. So we got a real problem if we allow these state stores to go by the wayside. Maybe the highlight of the testimony, Rick, they brought in some people, some students from Council Rock. They called themselves the Coalition for Healthy Youth. They were about five of them. There were two of them, Rick, believe it or not, that were 13 years old. The oldest was a senior. The senior, Theo Caputo, was the highlight. All of these teenagers really spoke with an intelligence and intuitiveness far beyond their years. They were excellent. Theo Caputo, he said up front, he said, I am a Republican. I am a conservative. I believe in the free market. But you cannot and should not privatize this system. And he went on to make some cogent points. First of all, he made the accusation, I think correctly so. He made the statement that the local beer distributorships will go out of business. And I believe not only locally but statewide there is a good chance. I mean, you look at Texas, Rick, if you think that accusation is inaccurate in Texas. And you can check this record. In Texas, within 5 years, every beer distributorship in the state went out of business when they privatized.
Wow.
He made a good point, which Republicans don't even want you to think about. Under the present system, the money is kept in the state. You make the profit, it comes back to the taxpayers of Pennsylvania. Privatization will have these big box stores take money out of state. Can you say Arkansas and Walmart? And you know that will happen. Alcoholism in this country kills on a yearly basis 79,000 people, which is an astounding number. The total cost to every man, woman, and child because of alcohol, $746. Some of those are astounding figures. And then the last group to appear, Rick, and we talked about this group several times, Mad Mothers. Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Again, this is a group that in the last big battle we had was very, very influential in making sure that bill didn't pass. They are composed for the most part of mothers whose children were killed by drunk drivers. And you can bet, again, and these are statistics that Republicans don't even want you to think about. They act like it's going to be seamless. And these accusations that crime related to alcohol is going to increase. Well, it actually is. And if you don't think so, then how do these Republicans justify the fact that we have the lowest rate, bona fide lowest rate of crime related to alcohol in the country if it doesn't make a difference? You know it will. I'm glad to see that the Mad Mothers are on board. I'd like to ask the question, and of course this is theoretical.
I've got an answer.
Where were they?
I've got an answer.
Where were they? I mean, it's great that they're on board, and I'm hoping that the governor waits till, and I hope that if there is a bill passed, that it isn't passed any sooner than early June. At least they're on board. You want to give a retort on that, Rick?
Well, no. I mean, the reality is that the reason, and I guess the argument you could make from the governor's point of view is, look. The reason that there are fewer drunk driving deaths and fewer drunk related crimes is because everybody's high. They're all smoking grass. They're all high on drugs, because that's why we have so many unemployed, because they're lazy and shiftless and they're drug addicts, can't pass a drug test. What our governor said. I mean, here's words for himself. One way to finish the evening, our governor's own words.
I heard that.
Well, here's our wonderful governor.
There are many employers that say, you know, we're looking for people, but we can't find anybody that has passed the drug test, a lot of them. And that's a concern for me, because we're having a serious problem with that.
Because they're all drug addicts. They're lazy and shiftless.
How desperate is this man?
No, look, man, it's not about desperate. It's about cash. Bring in the campaign cash. Bring the cash. And boatloads of it. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, RickSmithShow.com. Stitcher on the smartphone. See you back here tomorrow.
It's coming from the wind. You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the Buddha's sway. Imperial, mysterious, in amorous array. Democracy is coming.